Not exactly jumping whenever you snap your fingers, are they?
Not yet. But I've enjoyed authority too long to give it up easily. I'll be giving orders again, and they'll be obeyed. When that happens, I shall give a very special priority to you and your friend Avon.
Avon?
We met. Briefly.
Then he's alive.
The condition, I hope, is purely temporary.
Yes, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 5th of May, 2023, the day before the good old King Charles III's coronation, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please but Google. And do please feel free to record these programmes in case they get disappeared. That's happened in the past, certainly when we were on BCFM quite regularly. It'd be the end of the show, we'd be told by the station manager, oh, sorry, no programme got recorded. So anyway, I'm still Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, smearing the 30 pence a pill ivermectin COVID treatment, which could have saved 60,000 British lives, according to Tess Laurie from Bath. Anyway, that's all been replaced now by the Zio-Nazi hero Zelensky and the masochistic Russian sanctions, an unhappy bunch of Goldman Sachs, Bilderberg, Nazi death trip, deep state losers, the dark enlightenment zombies waging war on the British people now as well as the Russian people. So this is what the BBC might sound like were it free from the tentacles of the authoritarian deep state. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution and all the geopolitics involved is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So the first part, we'll be looking at our marvellous mayor, Marvin the Marvellous. He is added Yale to his official LinkedIn pages, someone has pointed out. And it's interesting, isn't it? We have a go and have a look at Yale. Yale's quite a centre for something called the Skull and Bones. And I dug out a clip today with a couple of, I think, interesting. That's one of them is Anthony Sutton. The other one is Webster Tarpley talking about what is the Skull and Bones at Yale University. We'll be looking at the massive oil company profits announced this week. Also something a little bit more prosaic, maybe, but the Badger Coal. Absolutely horrific Badger Coal still going on with no good reason at all. And we'll be hearing a bit from Mark Purdy about his campaign over many years to show that the links to TB in cattle had absolutely nothing to do with badgers, and much more to do with the sorts of chemicals that were being fed through the feed and injected into Britain's cows. Valerie Sinison, she's the one who was on the front page of the Daily Express talking about Savile's satanic ring a few years ago. Was it 2012, I think, that story popped up. But anyway, I've got. She's just brought a novel out, which it talks a lot about what she's seen as the sexual abuse system, including the VIP paedophile system out there, that's still absolutely still in full effect, apparently, according to her. And she's written a novel explaining. This is really for people who either have been abused themselves or know someone who's been abused, and the novel will help people. She hopes, anyway. Understand how things transpire, and how that whole paedophile system works. Obviously, we can't miss the coronation of the WEF King. We'll be revisiting A Bridge Too Far and also the Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile book, which is all connected with my work on Arnhem. And in part two, we'll hear from Olya. She's a Russian, but she's got parts of her family on both sides of the Ukraine war. This is a story you don't hear too often, certainly on the mass media. It's the sort of thing, of course, which is quite normal over in that part of the world, that you've got some people who are on one side, maybe Ukrainian speakers, other people in other parts of the family, Russian speakers or married into a Russian family. So we hear from her. What does she make about it all? And also, we've got the Kremlin. Apparently, have hit themselves with a drone. That is according to the mainstream media. Looking at the Rockefellers, And in two contexts. One is a documentary out by Vera Sharaf called it's one of the parts of her documentary called Never Again Is Now Global. We're All Jews Now. That's with the episode. And also A Man Called Intrepid, both looking at the role of the Rockefellers early on. Zev Zelenko looking at their role in the early part of the 20th century, and The Man Called Intrepid is a book written by a guy called William Stevenson, who wasn't the William Stevenson he was writing about in the book. That makes it even more confusing, so I better shut up about that. But it's a book is called A Man Called Intrepid, but the Rockefellers played a very, very important role in the Second World War behind the scenes. We've got Going Underground from RT, from Behind the Firewall, with talking to Cy Hirsch and John Perkins, two fascinating characters, and we wind up with the one and only Tim Cohen. He said, first of all, looking at, is carbon dioxide bad or good for the Earth? And secondly, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, his book, he takes us through what he believes will be King Charles's role in the future as a so-called peacemaker in a war that he's helped to create, that is to say, World War III. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then a few days later by Ofcom, following on their coattails. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. Martin, I'll just say something a little bit about the National Union of Journalists conference I was at last weekend in the TUC headquarters. Something's changed at the TUC. I think the last time I was there was probably a decade and a half ago, quite a long time. And it seems to have become a bit corporate, the TUC. What do you make of the way that the trade union's own trade union has changed over the years?
Well, the current trade union leadership are much more professional in their attitude than previous generations. And I think they've had to be, because the unions have struggled. The height of union density in this country was at 1979, when 13 million people were in trade unions. And it's gone down since then, of course, as a result of deindustrialisation and various, signature strikes like the miners' strike. So the unions have had to actually up their game.
And it was a disaster, the miners' strike, wasn't it?
Well, yes, of course it was. And of course, but that you've got to come back and you've got to work through it and try and rebuild. And they have, to a large extent, rebuilt. I think they are more, and you say more corporate, I would say that they're more professional about what they do. They've got to be. And I think that is actually paying dividends, because you've now got confidence by rank and file members in the leadership, and the leadership also taking account of rank and file opinions.
I mean, which in the past was not necessarily the case. It in Northern Ireland to what I experienced as Catholic and Protestant institutions. The TUC used to be a bit rough around the edges, that I would equivalent to the sort of Catholic way of doing things, like the Catholic shops in Enniskillen, where I was living there. And now it seems everything's very, very squeaky clean, very posh, lots of electronics everywhere. But I suppose that's just, they've just moved with the times as well. But I mean, they are quite a limited hangout, really, the TUC, aren't they?
Well, look, the trade union movement, like everything else, is a site of struggle. You've got, in the past, we had lots of problems with TUC, not TUC leaders, but leaders of individual unions, like the EPTU at Wapping, who were basically organising against the fellow workers. And, the right wing have occasionally, or quite frequently, sold out strikes and not really supported the people who've been on strike. But that's been true forever. It's always been a site of struggle. It still is.
Anyway, on the Saturday, we had a terrific motion. I'd missed it. What you basically get is a whole bunch of motions in agenda, it's called. This one doesn't come through the post. You have to read it online first, and you get a hard copy when you get to the conference. And one of the motions I'd missed was about Google. And that was on the afternoon of Saturday. And it was brilliant. I think it was London Magazine branch put together this motion, saying that the members should lead. The national executives should set up a member-led inquiry into the union's relationship with Google. Because actually, Martin, what's going on is quite a lot of the training, etc., that the union provides is paid for by Google.
Well, you can see this is one of the problems that you have in organising anything. Where does your money come from? And
there's a big pushback from the union itself, saying, no, we don't want to, we just want to take the money and do the training. You know, we don't want their members looking into this. You can see that
if you're doing anything, I've worked in the community sector and the non-governmental organisation world, and a lot of what you're doing is fundraising your own salary, which means that you go for everything, lottery funding, whatever. You know, if Google are offering you free money, you take it. Now, that can be problematic. Of course it can.
Well, I was chatting,
but where else are you going to get the money from?
I was chatting to one of the ladies from the Guardian Observer Chapel, and by the way, we're no longer allowed to call the organising within the workplaces chapels. We've got to call them, or is it Mother of Chapel? We're not allowed to call them that anymore, or Father of Chapel. I mean, you know, this is such a silly, but anyway, so chatting to her, I was sort of raising this question of electronic voting. We were all given these little electronic voting things, and actually it seemed to take longer to do that than it would to hold up your delegate card, Martin. I mean, I'm sure you've been to these conferences. There's a difference between pressing a button and waiting for the electronics to deal with it all than if you hold the cards up. It's a lot quicker because you can see immediately if there's a big majority, then it just, you know,
yeah, well,
it,
I mean, and you know, working in schools, it's great to have all this fantastic sort of screens where you can show videos and all the rest of it, and there's all sorts of tricks you can play, but when it's not working, it's not working, and you're back to how are we going to teach this lesson, but it's all on the computer, we can't open the screen.
The whole conference ground to a halt, as we discussed. I mean, you know, in the old days, up until about 10 years ago, we used to do sketches on the Saturday night, entertaining sort of little play-acting sketches about various things that had gone on at the conference. And this obviously would have been one of them. We're not allowed to do that anymore for some reason. But this is all to do with whether it's the numbers of people that voted on each side that's shown at the front at the end of the vote, or the percentage. So there's a whole load of wrangling over what should be shown. Obviously the percentage is easier, but you know, if only a handful of people have voted, then you realise that, you know, maybe it wasn't made clear enough when the voting started and when it finished, for example. So there's all sorts of problems with it. And the reason I mentioned the Guardian is to say, oh well, no, this is very efficient. I said, well, what happens if it gets out? Oh, who's going to hack us? She said, nobody's going to hack the NUJ. Well, she might be right, but on a crucial vote of some sort, say, for example, with foreign policy, it's not unfeasible that somebody in the United States might just get into that system remotely and decide, right, well, we want to make this the answer in this vote, is it?
Well, yes. I mean, there's going to be an issue about any system that you're using. I mean, the block vote worked, you know, voted by trade unions at Labour Party conference was notorious. And that, yeah, therefore they, you know, they cast millions of votes on the basis of one hand up, and that was then outvoted all the constituency partners of the Labour
system. Most of the stuff we were voting on is a simple majority. Surely hands is enough.
Well,
and if it's a fine vote, so for example, you've got almost the same number of hands going up for and against, then maybe you could have an electronic vote to sort it out.
Well, yes, I mean, but these are technical questions, aren't they? Yeah.
But it's just the technology, you know, creeping in everywhere. I find it rather irritating. And by the way, the Google vote, we won. As one 4 years ago.
Was it an electronic Google vote?
It was.
Oh, there you are. Yeah, you see, yeah, man, yeah. You, even with electronics against you, you can win.
Yes, you can. Maybe it was much bigger than they really said, than the display told us. But so 4 years ago, we had a vote about whether the union should look into Google algorithms which were making candidates in elections. It's a piece we did on this show, actually, by a guy, I think his name was Professor Robert Epstein in the States, who had shown that you can, by an algorithm, you can skew the election results by 30%. So if you're looking up a candidate, you can make 30% of the results positive stories about them, or 30% of the results negative stories about them. And so and I just lost that one, or we, you know, various of us who were voting or speaking on one side or the other, and this time we won just by 48% to 52%. Still not quite sure how many votes it was. Anyway, enough on that, because it was May Day on Monday, wasn't it, Martin? What were you up to here in Bristol?
Well, I went to the Trades Council march, which was, I wouldn't say it's massively well attended. It was about 150 people, I'd say. So I suppose when there's not that many, it makes a difference if you turn up.
It's not many in a Labour city, is it? I mean, you'd think potentially.
Well, it wasn't very well
advertised by the
it
council.
It wasn't very well advertised. Somebody had mentioned it when I was at the Radical History Conference the other week, and so I knew about it through that. But I wouldn't have been able to. I wouldn't probably have known about it otherwise. So I just went down. The nurses were on strike that day, so they were outside the BRI. So we had a little band playing. We marched up outside the BRI, you know, greeted the striking nurses, and then they went down back to Castle Park and had a few speeches. So it was very low-key, but generally positive atmosphere.
So who was doing the speeches?
I didn't hang around for the speeches, oh, okay. Tony. But most of the public...
Southwest TUC, maybe?
Well, no, it's, no? The TUC...
Trades Council.
Trades Councils are a different structure from TUC.
Yes, they are, yeah. Well, I used to be on it, yeah.
Yeah, so they're very different.
It was always a bit lacklustre, Bristol's Trades Council. I mean, it's funny, but Bridgewater Trades Council, massive, does loads of stuff.
Well,
several
the,
events
the Radical
during the
History
year.
Group last week, there was a guy called Phil something or other. He's a very old militant trade unionist from the southwest, and I think he's from that part of the world. And yeah, because of course, you know, that part of the world where is you know, coal mining districts and so on. You know, so there's quite a lot of you know, history out there. But anyway, it was worth doing, and there was generally a positive attitude from the public, as we, you know, people came out of the pubs and claps and things. The band helped, of course, music.
So what sort of band was it?
It was a jazz band, you know.
Lovely, that sounds good.
Upbeat music, you know. But of course, it was all mostly elderly people like myself. We didn't have loads and loads and loads of youngsters.
Yes, the Quakers is a bit like that.
Well, I mean, I'm afraid lots of things are a bit like that. You know, and unless a younger generation comes forward, eventually these things die out, don't they?
So we've had elections yesterday, local authority elections, not here in Bristol, but we have in South Gloucestershire, which is really part of Bristol. Apparently, South Gloucestershire's voted for no overall control. So, what do you make of that?
Obviously, I haven't had time to look at the detailed results. I've obviously heard the general, you know, the general stuff that's been on the mainstream media. I don't know what that means in South Gloucestershire as such. I mean, it used to be Tory control.
Yes, it was. It's now overall control.
I mean, that means that the Tories have fallen back, which is pretty much the picture we've seen around the country, isn't it?
Conservatives have been almost completely wiped out of Bath and North East Somerset. That's funny. That's Jacob Rees-Mogg's constituency.
Well, no, I think he's
well, it's very close to him.
It's close to him, but don't forget, Bath is a bit different.
It's a town, yeah. He's a rural constituency, yeah. But it's right next door to Jacob. He must be quaking in his top hat.
Jacob Rees-Mogg did not win 50% of the vote in his constituency, and if there'd been a proportional election, he wouldn't be an MP.
Well, hardly anyone does, do they? Because there's usually several parties, usually about four parties.
Well, no, but
how can anyone be expected to win 50%?
Well, no, in some constituencies, it's clear that somebody got 50%. That does happen. In some parts of the country, that's definitely the case. But, you know, lots of places it isn't true, and therefore you get all sorts of perverse results, largely in favour of the Tories, because the other parties are the opposition to
this
them.
This is not a great ringing endorsement for Sunak, is it? I mean, basically what's happened is, as the Tories have jettisoned Boris, as predicted, the public don't like Sunak so much. I mean, they actually seem to dislike Starmer more, but so they're jettisoning the traditional Tories for Lib Dems and Greens and people like that.
Well, that's it. Clearly the pattern. I think that from the Labour Party's point of view, it looks this morning as if they got an 8-point lead as a result of this election, which isn't enough for them to form a government on their own, even if that were repeated at a general election, which is not clear it would be. So Starmer's still got a lot of work to do if he wants to be, you know, undisputed Prime Minister. But I don't necessarily think that's what will happen. I think it's quite possible that the general election will be much tighter than that, and the Labour Party will probably be the biggest party, but it won't be able to form a government on its own. That's what I predict, but we'll have to see.
So let's just have a look at the various parties. There's Labour have added 400, so doing quite well. Conservatives down 747. The Lib Dems up 257, Independents minus 57, Greens have added 173. So this is the pattern, isn't it? Actually, Labour, Lib Dem and Green are picking up all these Tory and other votes.
Well, they're picking up the votes of those that don't want a Tory government.
Labour are doing better than the other two. You'd expect that, though, wouldn't you?
Well, they're bigger. And, of course, you know, you do, because the Labour Party is a national party, you do get a residual Labour vote, even in Tory constituencies where it might make more sense for people to vote Lib Dem. But I think the electorate's becoming more sophisticated as well. At local elections, they know it. They can vote green because they can get a local councillor elected where they wouldn't have much chance of getting an MP elected.
The funny thing is the Lib Dems have done slightly better than 2019 and 2022 local elections. And so, or general election 2019, wasn't it? So the funny thing about that is that it's almost like the Clegg factor seems to be, as people forget Clegg, then they're more prepared to vote Lib Dem.
Yeah, well, I think the Liberals... Democrats cause themselves enormous problems by going into coalition with the Tories. I mean, in large parts of the country, they were seen as the main opposition to the Tories. So going into coalition with them disheartened their core supporters.
Do you remember Steve Comer, who actually was one of the main people that got the Lib Dems in, did a hell of a lot of work to get the Lib Dems in to power here in Bristol. After a year of the coalition, he just thought he'd been banging his head against a big brick wall with Clegg, and he left the country.
Well, that's
retired.
Right.
Well, you may have been retired.
Yeah, I mean, but of course, it's because of the nature, as I keep on banging on about this, it's because of the nature of the electoral system.
But the whole system's rigged, really, isn't it?
There must be temptation
for people to say there's no point in voting, really.
Well, you may say that, and then you can think about the alternatives, which is you can either set up an anarchist collective and try and manage things like that, or you can turn to armed struggle. Maybe just trade unionism. What are the alternatives?
Well, just shrug your shoulders and say, well, there's nothing I can do about it, and disengage completely.
Well, that's right. And in actual fact, that's what they want. That's what loads of people have been refused a vote in this election because they didn't have photo ID. And that those people are overwhelmingly people who probably would have voted Labour, Lib Dem or Green.
Yeah, because
there
are a lot of people out there that aren't maybe computer literate, don't do foreign travel.
I know loads of people who haven't got any photo ID, and they tend to be the more marginal people.
Well,
you don't have a driving license if you don't have a car, and you don't have a passport if you don't go on foreign holidays. So that's it.
Well, the elections watchdog has said the council contests were well run. Well, what a load of rubbish from these so-called watchdog of the elections. This is the Electoral Commission who brought this in. In the Mirror, well, we've got loads of stories, which will be in the papers tomorrow, no doubt, about various people who found it impossible to vote. Local elections were a dark day for British democracy. After photo ID rules block votes, a cabinet minister described the introduction of voter ID as a thoroughly good thing. Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because he's a Tory and he's got plenty of money and he's more likely, his voters are more likely to have a photo ID, despite claims thousands were left unable to vote in Thursday's local elections. Chris Heaton-Harris, the Northern Ireland secretary, that's what he said. It's a thoroughly good thing, voter ID.
Well, I think I read an interesting piece in the London Review of Books over the weekend, and there is some problem with postal voting in terms of people, you know, basically gathering postal votes and you know, packing them in. But that's nothing to do with photo ID, because postal voters don't have to show any ID.
Amazing, isn't it? And it's easier to do fraud on a postal vote anyway. And there's no,
evidence of widespread fraud.
So this is all about stopping poor people voting.
Well, it's taken out of the Republican Party playbook in the United States, where it's absolutely the case that they want to keep the people off the electoral register. So, for example, if you've got any criminal conviction in many states of the US, that could be for drunk driving, possession of marijuana, you never vote again, ever. And this is a deliberate attempt to push loads of people
A lot of people are calling this the zero trust agenda, aren't they? This is it being introduced in many aspects of life, where you've got to have some kind of electronic proof of who you are before you can do anything.
Yes, and I think that's a wider issue about whether, you know, we could have had ID cards, for example, and if we did have ID cards, then everybody would have a photo ID, wouldn't they?
Well, not necessarily, because some people would lose them, some people simply wouldn't have them.
Yes, all right, the other thing that could be done, quite straightforwardly, is just register everybody to vote at the age of 18 or 16.
And some people have chaotic lives. They just can't organise this sort of thing. But they are who they say they are.
Yes, that's why you register to vote. One of the problems with our system is you've got to actively register to vote. You could actually say to people, we will register to vote. You will be registered to vote. All you've got to do is turn up in Australia. If you don't turn up, you can be fined £1,000.
Political parties, actually, when they're going knocking on doors, sometimes help people to register to vote.
Well, yes, I've done that, working for the Labour
Party.
Very
sensible thing to do.
You know, we can give you a form now, fill it in, and you'll get. But, of course, it shouldn't be left to chance. Everybody.
Well, this isn't chance. It's not quite chance.
No,
is it?
It's a deliberate attempt to push people off the electoral register. Then, of course, you redraw the electoral boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers. And we know that in inner city areas, there are millions of people, or possibly less than that, but certainly a million, not registered to vote. And that's much less likely in rural areas. And that means that the constituency boundaries are redrawn. And that means that
these horror stories
are underrepresented.
It's a bit like the smart motorways, isn't it? Turn the hard shoulder into a fast lane and you're going to kill people. So this is exactly the same. If you tell everyone they've got to have photo ID before they vote, even though they've always voted in a trustworthy manner and never caused any problem, it's bound to mean that poorer people don't vote. It's obvious.
It's a further barrier.
Oxford MP fears significant numbers of voters have been turned away today for having no photo ID in the Leila Moran, that's her name, Oxford MP, and in the Daily Mirror, a nurse stopped from voting at the end of a long shift as Tories told to scrap photo ID rules. But these are like a ratchet, aren't they? They're not going to do that because the Tories have introduced all sorts of systems in order to try and make it more difficult for poor people to vote, and it's to their own advantage.
Well, that's true. But that means if they were beaten at the next election, and I hope they are,
they're cheating.
Well, they've always cheated, Tony. Why is anybody surprised?
Through boundary commissions.
Well,
and
not just the boundary commission. First past the post in a multi-party system, which we've got in this country, it privileges the party of power, the Tory party. Yeah, because you've got more than one opposition party.
That makes they get
an inherent advantage in everything that's done. Don't forget the House of Lords is absolutely packed with Tory cronies.
Only a year to go until our Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees is replaced. But it's funny, isn't it? It's taken 2 years. We voted to get rid of him, but he's taken 2 years to go. He's hanging on and trying to sign off as many planning permissions as he can, I think, in the meantime. Bristol City Council's moving to a committee model of governance and scrapping the role of mayor. In exactly a year's time, the leader will carry out many of the same roles as the current mayor, but they'll be chosen by a majority of councillors. So they generally tend to be the leader of the largest single party. A decade after the role was first introduced, that's with three terms of a mayor. That was first of all George Ferguson, and then Marvin Rees, and Marvin Rees again. We're going to a committee model of governance, Martin.
Well, that's right. And what will happen is what used to happen before that, before we had a mayor, elected mayor, and the largest party will, if they've got enough votes, will choose whoever's going to lead the council.
As well as the council leader, the cabinet members, which are handpicked and paid quite a bit more by the mayor, will be replaced by the committee chairs of the various parts of the council's work. Now, it's just a much more sensible way, isn't it?
Well, it's the more traditional way of doing things in this country. This presidential approach is not really consistent with the way that Britain, in theory, is governed. But of course, with the prime ministers in Britain have become increasingly presidential, and they are in a position to, you know, they've got more power, in fact, than a US president. And this has led to the whole personalization of politics. We want strong leaders, blah, 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 rather than, you know, boring committees, which don't, you know, haven't got the charisma of whoever.
So we've got at least that's a bit of good news, really. Something positive happening, something better in terms of governance, rather than this dictatorial system, which was always talked about as a dictatorship, even before it was began to become one under Marvin Rees, the mayor. So this week, I'm not sure if it was this week that it happened. It was certainly the first time various people, including me, noticed it. The mayor, Marvin Rees, has put up on his CV, I think it's on LinkedIn or something, his time at Yale University. He went to Harvard and he went to Yale. These are very expensive universities, Martin. And what happens is with these global leadership programs is specific individuals, sometimes as early as when they're teenagers, get tapped up effectively and told, you're going to be one of tomorrow's leaders. And then they get trained for the job. I mean, you did PPE at Oxford, but you got in the hard way. These people, they get given basically a place to do the Prime Minister's degree.
No, what happens is, don't forget, Marvin Rees did his first degree at Cardiff University. So he then did further study in the US.
Well, I'm talking about the Rhodes Scholarships. There's quite a few of these schemes.
The Rhodes Scholarships and all of that sort of stuff is generally for postgraduates, not entirely. And it's money that's put aside. Of course, you know, and
Bill Clinton, let's face it, was a bit of a simpleton, right?
No, he wasn't a genius of any sort. Well, no, he wasn't a genius.
He got tapped up and he got sent to Oxford to do PPE.
Yes, that's right. But it's fairly common for people at his level to do something like that because it's all part of what you do.
When you say at his level,
he was
a student when he got tapped up.
Yes, I know. But the point is that these networks of patronage, which is what they are, yeah. If you get a scholarship, you can be paid. You know, they will pay for you to go and do what it is. You don't have to pay for it.
Well, the question
of course,
is,
there's a temptation to say, "Well, right, I'll go and do that because they're going to pay for me to do it."
The question
and therefore
is,
that's why you do it.
What are the criteria? That's the question. And why is it that we now have to put up with this kind of management gobbledygook from our mayor all the time? Let's have a listen now to a little thing about Yale University, which includes good old, starts with Webster Tarpley. I mean, I can always remember being told, oh, you've got to steer clear of the LaRouche organisation. Are they dodgy, Martin, LaRouche?
Well, LaRouche, it's Lyndon LaRouche. See, is a figure most people will never have heard of him, but he's reasonably well known in political circles.
It was called LaRouche Public Affairs Committee, yeah, wasn't it? It was a rich American that set up a kind of think tank.
Yeah, well, the LaRouche organisation, which Tarpley was at one stage a member,
he worked for them, yeah.
Yes, it's seen as more democratic an orientation than Republican, in the sense that it believes in big government.
Well, the funny thing about LaRouche is they think the Brits are responsible for everything.
Oh, yeah. Well,
the Brits are at the heart of it.
You will see
And you know what? They could be right.
Well, populists in the US have always seen the hand of Britain behind things that they don't like in the US.
I don't think anyone as much as the LaRouche organisation. Yeah, everything that's... It's not the Americans, it's the Brits. Can you just answer, before we hear from Webster Tarpley and Anthony Sutton about the Yale Skull and Bones Club, what do you make of the who is in charge, Britain or America or Israel even, maybe?
Well, in actual fact, it's a transatlantic elite which are intermarried. So after Margaret Thatcher finished being prime minister, she spent lots of time in Texas with her son, and Rishi Sunak has spent an awful lot of time in California, and he's originally from Punjab. You know, these people don't have the same roots necessarily. And of course, across the Atlantic, Boris Johnson was born in the US. Yeah, these people are intermarried, interrelated, and they go to each other's universities to go to parties together, and then they get well, then they go
I
then they run the world
in
together.
In the media,
don't they?
There's this thing called the British American Project for the Successor Generation, which brought together people like producers and news anchors from national press in the US and the UK to just make them buddies.
Well,
Let's be buddies.
And a lot of what happens in universities is networking for your future life. I was rather remiss in that. I went to the wrong kind of parties with the wrong kind of people.
No, Martin, you went to the right kind of parties.
And I didn't end up running the world.
I can assure you.
Surprisingly enough.
You went to the right kind of parties. That's why you're not running the world. But that's because you've still got a brain of your own. Right. Marvin Rees has added Yale to his CV. Let's have a listen to Webster Tarpley and Anthony Sutton talking about this dark side of Yale University.
And the emissaries of the various secret societies would come up behind them, tap them on the shoulder and say something like, Skull and Bones, do you accept? And generally, of course, they did accept. And then as the people were tapped, they then left the courtyard and proceeded to the vault-like or mausoleum-like headquarters of these secret societies. That, I think, since has been abolished or moved indoors or somehow is no longer so easy to observe as it might have been, say, 50 or 100 years ago.
Initiation ceremony. They have an initiation ceremony. Somebody gets dumped naked in a bath of mud. Well,
to me, that seems juvenile. And what concerns me is these are the men in which the fortunes and the life of the world depend. This is the part that worries me. I mean, whether you want to go around and do that, it's your business. You know, you can stay in mud all day long, as far as I'm concerned, and baths of mud. But don't take this man and put him in control of world policy, which can bring about war and famine and heaven knows what else. This is what worries me.
Part of the problem is the source of information. We have very little about the bones from the tomb itself, and most comes indirectly, such as an article written by a student that went to Yale and actually lived in the Jonathan Edwards dorm, and he had this to say. It was part of the Jonathan Edwards folklore that on the April evening following Cap Night at Bones, if one could climb to the Tower of Weir Hall, the odd castle that overlooks the Bones courtyard, one could hear strange cries and moans coming from the bowels of the tomb as the 15 newly tapped members were put through what sounded like a harrowing ordeal. Returning alone to my room late at night, I would always cross the street rather than walk the sidewalk that passed right in front of Bones. Even at that safe distance, something about it made my skin crawl.
Yes, well, you see, when they're initiated, I think part of the process is that they're leaving this life and being born into another life. And good and evil is part of this duality process. So what really they do is they take a world in which man essentially tries to be good, tries to have good objectives, because basically this is the only reason we've survived as humanity, is because most of us have good objectives. They've taken that objective and they've reversed it. And they've made their end to be destruction and death. Not death for the 15 in the cell, death for everybody else. That's the meaning behind the symbolism.
So that's quite an elderly sounding Anthony Sutton. That may have been one of the last interviews he did there, talking about Skull and Bones at Yale. Now, this was set up by something called the Russell Trust, connected up with money made from the sale of opium, Martin, apparently many years ago, and connected with a German lodge. So this is Masonic, some would even say satanic, the Skull and Bones.
Well, yeah, they're not the only organisation of that kind, are they? I mean, P2 in Italy was another organisation, or, you know, with mafia connections, intelligence service connections and so on.
Isn't it interesting how it's all based at, like, at the university? The universities have got a kind of squeaky clean image, less so maybe now with the commercialisation of it, but it's quite clever to set it up at the university.
Well, no, it's what you'd expect. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any suggestion in Marvin's CV that he's in Skull and Bones.
No, there isn't. No,
I think,
but it's an interesting thing.
I think we ought to make that clear to the listeners before we proceed. I mean, Skull and Bones, you know, you've got to be recruited into it. Yeah. And the same is true of quite a lot of organisations.
Well, haven't seen the membership list. It's not impossible that he's been tapped up.
Well, all right. Well, I mean, I doubt it, is all I'll say. Because, of course, there's loads of people who go to Harvard and Yale who are not in Skull and Bones. Just like there's loads of people who go to Oxford University who are not in the Bullingdon Club. Not least because you have to go to Eton to be in the Bullingdon Club. And if you didn't go to Eton, you can't be in it. There's all sorts of organisations and universities.
This is very tempting, you know, isn't it?
Some of them are open, some of them are private. It's very tempting
for people when you're tapped up and told, look, you can be part of this secret club and we can guarantee you loads of money until you die. It's a bit tempting to say yes, isn't it?
Well, it's being part of the ruling class elite, yeah, and having the connections that implies. And that means that even if you're a useless loser like George W. Bush, who just basically drank his and snorted his way through university and the National Guard and not fighting in Vietnam, he can still be president because he's part of Skull and Bones. He's one of us. And therefore he can be, you know, slotted in. And he was slotted in.
In the meantime, of course, we've got, I think it'd be useful, we had a look last week at this whole idea of interest rates. It was an article, I think it was in the Daily Express, expressing bemusement that the idea that by putting up interest rates, that might actually bring inflation down. Do you want to just recap, Martin, on the logic behind that, if there is any?
Well, it's actually straightforward economics textbook stuff.
It's not straightforward. It might be in the textbook, but it doesn't seem to make sense, does it?
Well, it does, because interest rate, in countries like Britain, where the interest rate affects things like the mortgage rate, that can in fact increase inflation because people, as interest rate goes up, people's mortgages go up. Now, in actual fact, what they've done is they stripped that out of the RPI anyway. So, like a lot of things, in like a lot of statistics, yeah. It's manipulated. But the basic idea is quite simple. The central bank controls the interest rate, and that's the only mechanism they do control, because they certainly don't control the money supply. And what they do is when they raise interest rates, that means that credit conditions tighten, and therefore businesses go bust.
So it becomes less easy to borrow money.
Yes, and businesses go bust, and as they go bust, the economy starts to go down, and as it goes down, the inflation comes down.
Well, surely, if businesses are going bust, the competition don't have to compete anymore, so they can start price fixing.
What happens in these situations?
And that means prices will go up.
What happens in these situations is there are further monopolisation. Yeah, so certain businesses go out of business, and then they're cannibalised by other businesses. So Lehman Brothers is cannibalised by I can't remember what the name of the bank was. But, I mean, the point is that all these banks that are going bust in the US are all being cannibalised by bigger banks.
JP Morgan and Goldman.
As Michael Hudson's pointed out, the purpose of this is to get inflation out of the system, but the purpose is to force wages down, because if you put people out of work and create more unemployed, that forces wages down, which then keeps profitability up in theory. Although what you can do, and I think what's likely to happen in this situation, is they're in a no-win situation, because by increasing interest rates, they're going to crash the economy.
I mean, just imagine
that will just be catastrophic.
Just imagine I'm running a widget factory in South Bristol. Say, let's imagine that the widgets are tyres for cars. The chances are I will have borrowed money over the last whatever it is 15 years or so rather cheap in order to expand my business. Suddenly, as interest rates go up, I'm having to pay a lot more repayments on those loans. Therefore, I'm going to have to put the price of my tyres up, aren't I?
If you can put the price up. If you're in a market where you've got monopoly power, then you can put the price up, and that increases inflation.
But if you don't put the prices up, you won't be able to pay back the loan. Well, so you'll go under.
Yes, you go under.
So you have to put the price up. You're not really given much of a choice.
No, you can't. You're either a price taker or a price maker. And now some firms are price makers. They tend to be the bigger firms because they've got monopoly power. Other firms are price takers, like small farmers, for example. They cannot just raise the prices of their stuff. The supermarkets won't buy it. Yeah. So the structure of the market
go to your local farm shop, folks.
Well, yes, if you've got a local farm shop, and then you might find that's more expensive than the supermarket.
This is interesting because the recent shortage of eggs apparently wasn't due to an actual shortage of eggs. It was because the supermarkets were lowered the price that they were prepared to buy eggs for, and a lot of the egg producers were just refusing to sell at that price.
Yeah, so you've got problems of
monopolies.
A lot of the problems
with these supermarkets surely must all work together
to a certain extent. They do, but what you've got is an unstable oligarchy. Oligopoly is the norm in capitalist economies. Yeah, so you have occasionally new entrants can fight their way into the market, like Lidl and Asda did. Yeah. And occasionally they consolidate, and when things are going down, some companies may go bust.
Well, and if Deutsche Bank gave me 25 billion, I could start a supermarket chain and start to edge my way into the market, couldn't I? That's the way these things work.
Yes, but they're not going to give you 25 billion, are they? And therefore, the people.
Well, my name is not Mr. Aldi, is it?
No, well, I know, but the thing is that the retail is actually relatively competitive, but it's also, of course, remember the supermarkets are much less. Much more concentrated than the previous system of having lots of small shops.
Yeah. And market towns.
Yes, and all of that. Yeah. So it's quite, I mean, and of course it's all based around the car and people being able to drive to the supermarket.
No, and lorries, yes, distributing it all around the country.
That's right. So you've got to have a whole infrastructure for it to work like that.
Mm. Well, maybe that should be a bit more taxed. And maybe there should be tax breaks for smaller grocery stores, supermarkets, mini markets,
you want to decide what you want, and then you've got to plan to have it. I mean, at one stage, the cooperative shops were the dominant retail force in British society. because they were cooperatives, they didn't have to pay certain taxes because they were friendly societies, which gave them a competitive edge over the private sector.
Oh no, you know what it was? It was those Green Shield stamps. That's what made them so
Green Shield
successful.
Stamps was profit sharing. Yeah, which was right. Another aspect of that's why the cooperatives.
Anyway, we are kind of getting off the subject. Sorry, me bowling you a few googlies there. But let's have a listen now to Peter Schiff talking about the effect of the raising of interest rates, and we'll hear from you, Martin, what you make of what he's got to say. He's a wealthy US advisor, and he does, I think it's a YouTube channel that he's got, but he also does advice for people on what to invest in.
No money is safe now in the bank, because either your bank is going to fail and you will lose your money, or your bank won't fail because the government bails it out and your money will lose its purchasing power. So either way, you should withdraw your money now, but don't stick it under your mattress because it's going to lose purchasing power there too. You've got to convert it to real money. You've got to turn it into gold. Now, if banks could offer you a high enough rate of interest to offset the inflation, then that might be an incentive to leave the money in the bank. But the banks can't do that because they can't afford it because they're broke, because they've already locked up all their deposits in long-term, low-yielding mortgages and treasuries, so they can't pay you enough to offset the loss of inflation, but they can't stop you from withdrawing your money. The problem is they don't have the money because the money has been lost. That's what happened to Silicon Valley Bank or Signature Bank. So as more people rush to withdraw their money from banks and use it to buy gold, the Federal Reserve is going to have to print more money to enable those withdrawals, which is going to create even more inflation, which is going to accelerate the appeal of gold and cause even more people to deplete their bank accounts to buy gold. And then it's a vicious circle of, you know, collapsing banks and runaway inflation. We will absolutely return to a gold standard. I mean, a gold standard has been the monetary system that has dominated through most of recorded human history. And I don't think that that's changed. I think we've temporarily experimented with fiat currency. The experiment is going to end in disaster, and it will prompt a return to what works, and that is gold. And whether it's governments or the private sector that lead the way, ultimately that's where we're going to go.
So that's Peter Schiff there, Martin. You agree with his analysis? Gold standard, that's where we're going. He's certainly saying that as these banks start to go bust and they start to crank up interest rates, so your money is going to be potentially become worthless.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said
if you've
for that.
Got any.
Yeah, well, Schiff is coming out there with what's been a fairly standard opinion amongst people like him for many decades, which is that ultimately gold is, we're going to go back to a gold standard. And of course, the gold standard as practiced by the British Empire with the pound on gold and transferable into gold was a system which at the height of the British Empire, the world system functioned around that. At Bretton Woods in 1944, what happened was that there was it was actually quite a flexible system. Obviously, what Keynes wanted to do was to create a non-gold super system, which wouldn't be based on gold or anything else at all, or even on national currencies. He wanted Bancor. But what they eventually agreed is that the dollar would be the key to the, you know, that would become the world's currency.
It was handy for the Americans, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, very handy, but it was supposedly converted into gold at an agreed price. And now, of course, in actual fact, in order to keep the Vietnam War going, they ran, you know, they basically wanted to spend money. So they, what they did at that point is they took the dollar off gold. And then, of course, people like General de Gaulle just turned up with their dollars and said, we want gold for this. And so they had to take it off the gold standard. So that's where fiat money came from.
How does that link up with the petrodollar? Because
the petrodollar was then created in 1973. That was the fallback position.
It sort of took over. Your dollar is good for oil, not gold anymore.
That's right. And of course, the petrodollar system is now collapsing. Now, what I think is going to happen is that there is going to be a new gold standard, but it will be similar to what happened in the British Empire. It won't be just people having gold and exchanging nuggets with each other. There will be an alternative global currency based on gold and other commodities.
Well, what about carbon credits? That seems to be the big flavour of the month.
But that's more of them trying to make stuff up. I mean, it's just irrelevant. I'm talking about real money now. Carbon credits are to do with...
Well, if you want to do stuff, you might need to buy some carbon credits in order to
well,
do
yes,
it,
and, yes, as long as everybody, say, as long as everybody's agreed about carbon credits, but the Russians and the Chinese are not going to agree about carbon credits with us. They're just not. We're at war with them. They're not going to do that. And what they're doing, Sergei Glazyev has been tasked by this by Putin, is to talk to the Chinese about how we can develop an alternative world currency, which isn't the dollar, and it won't necessarily be the Chinese currency either. The new world currency will be an agreed currency with a link to gold and other commodities.
So actually, the BRICS countries don't really have anywhere near such a bad problem, do they?
Well, they've got a big problem, because and the problem is us. You know, if we weren't there, they could probably manage. But of course,
it's going to affect trade, obviously, if the Western currency, the pound and the dollar and the euro system, starts to go crunch. But surely they're in a better position, aren't they, the BRICS countries?
Well, they want to break the dollar system. This is what this is all about.
Oh, okay.
They're fed up with it, as are many other countries. We mentioned what's going on in the US, and there's always this, what you might call narcissistic navel-gazing. The real problem is that the developing countries, from Argentina to Sudan and all these other places, they have got to repay their debts in dollars, and their currencies are collapsing. So they can't prepay those debts, and they're all going to default. Now, what they should do is refuse to pay those debts and just cancel them. And that's what that would then crash the banking system in the West. But
the Americans,
it's got to go.
The Americans thought that the SWIFT payment system and the dollar and the IMF, etc., were the international banking system. But what's been happening is countries which are opposed to them politically have sorted out their own systems, alternatives.
It's not quite clear whether they've done it yet. There's a very depressing article by Patrick Bond, who's a South African economist, saying that, you know, this isn't in the bag yet. That it's definitely a possibility.
Well,
everybody's talking about it.
When Russia was booted out of SWIFT, they had another payment system ready to go like that.
That's right. And in actual fact, the sanctions that have been placed on Russia and now increasingly on China mean that they've been pushed to do what they could have done for themselves, which is to put tariff barriers in position against Western goods and then develop their own alternatives.
Slightly gobsmacked to read today, the United States is Biden is putting sanctions on Sudan as well. These economic warfare around the world just seems completely insane. And it's not insane. It's the only tool they've got left in order to try and disrupt countries, disturb countries, disrupt countries to punish them for not doing what they're told.
Well, as Michael Hudson and Radhika Desai point out in the article I read yesterday, all the West has got to offer the developing world is do as we say or we will punish you. Whereas what the Russians and the Chinese are saying, hey, work with us and we will work with you to improve your situation.
Sounding a bit like the fall of the Roman Empire.
Well, it is. Of course it is. I mean, it's an inhuman system, and it's been manipulated beyond, Hudson's book, Super Imperialism, came out in 1972. And he was explaining the Americans basically, by using, they're the bankers in Monopoly. Yeah. You've got to use my money. You can't buy anything without my money, and I'm the one who controls that. So they're able to pay for stuff that they buy from the rest of the world with money they print, and they don't have to pay. They don't really pay for any of their imports.
Well, look, on Wednesday this week, talking about crazy systems.
Mr. Speaker, the only power is given to local communities not to build houses. And we know why he won't change course. He admitted it last month. His councillors simply don't want to build the houses local people need, so he's given them a way out. Picture the scene as he explains this to a family. Mum and dad paying $4,000 extra on the mortgage because the Tories tanked the economy. Their eldest paying hundreds more in rent. Their youngest still stuck in the spare room because they need an extra £9,000 for a deposit. Then along comes the Prime Minister and merrily tells them, sorry for crashing the economy. We don't want to talk about that. Sorry I can't help you with the house building, but my councillors don't like it. Oh, and before I go, here's a massive council tax increase for your troubles. Why doesn't he stop the excuses, stop blaming everyone else, and just build some houses instead?
Mr. Speaker, our memories on that short. We all know what happened last time when they were in power. There was no money left for the country. But let's about, let's talk about the record. Let's talk about the Labour record on house building, Mr. Speaker. In London, the former Conservative mayor built 60,000 affordable homes in his first 5 years in office. How many do the current Labour mayor manage? Half of that, Mr. Speaker. In Wales, we need 12,000 new homes a year. How many have Labour built in the last year? Half of that, Mr. Speaker. As ever, Labour talk and the Conservatives deliver.
Mr. Speaker. Debt doubled since 2010.
Yep.
Growth down.
Yep.
Tax up. The economy crashed. Mr. Speaker, they're going to need a bigger note. And it's right. But week after week, we debate the issues facing in this place. But looking beyond the elections tomorrow, we also have a hugely significant weekend coming up with the King's coronation. For most, this will be the first time they've seen a monarch crown. And I hope, and I know across the House, people will hope, that people across the country enjoy the ceremony, the street parties, and of course, the extra day off. 300 million will tune in. The world will see our country at its best, celebrating the beginning of a new chapter in our history. But it will also be a reminder of the loss of our late Queen, Elizabeth II, and a chance again to remember all that she gave to our country through her dedicated service. So will the Prime Minister join me in honouring our late Queen and wishing the new King a long and happy reign?
Yes. Mr. Speaker, as I said at the outset, we're all looking very much forward to the coronation. It will be a very special moment in the history of our country, and I know that we will join with the country in celebrating it. But before we get to the coronation weekend, Mr. Speaker, we have an important day tomorrow, and the choice before the country is clear. When they go to that ballot box, they can see a party that stands for higher council tax, higher crime, and a litany of broken promises, Mr. Speaker. Meanwhile, we're getting on with delivering what we say, with lower council tax, lower crime, and fewer potholes. The choice is clear. Vote Conservative, Mr. Speaker.
Well, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. They didn't vote Conservative, they voted for Starmer's party.
Well, what may happen now is that those who are unhappy in the Conservative Party may decide to get rid of Sunak.
The knives are out.
Well, they may come out. I don't know what the psychology of this is, because I'm not a Tory. So I think they would be foolish to think that they could do any better with anybody else.
Okay, so
but you can't, you know, there's plenty of foolish people in the Tory party.
There is this idea abroad, which I think is certainly a fascinating one. Whether it's true or not, it's difficult to know. But certainly my source is pretty well placed, and that is that the Tories don't actually want to win.
I think there are plenty of Tories backbenchers who know that they're not going to win.
They don't. Mark Martin, you missed the point. They know the economy is headed for a crash in maybe a year or 2 years' time, and they don't want to be in power when that happens. They much rather a Gordon Brown-style 2008 sort of situation where the Labour Party have to deal with it and suffer all the flack because of an economic disaster.
I think if the Tory party was a more rational animal, they would be thinking like that, but the kind of people who might think like that have been booted out of the Tory party.
Well, it might
Michael
be like,
Heseltine probably thinks like that, but he's not in the Tory party anymore.
In the high ranks of the current Tory party, that might be a very good electoral strategy, mightn't it? Let's let Labour deal with the rather nasty situation coming down the line, and then we will then get elected after that and pick up the pieces.
Well, I think that's probably, if they lose the next election, and I hope and I expect they will, that's exactly what they will do, because of course the international crisis will continue. And the Labour Party will not necessarily have the necessary will to do the necessary things to deal with that. And therefore they can feel that they might be able to come back on the back of that. But, the real underlying all of this is that none of them are facing up to the reality of what's happening, which is that the global capitalist economy is on its last legs. We're at war with Russia and China, because that's already happening, and we can't possibly win. And nobody's really talking about what does a country like Britain do when it's made such humongous false decisions over decades. I mean, we've really boxed ourselves into a corner here. All of the privatisation of the national utilities. I mean, that's just, you know, a done deal, and it puts you at a complete disadvantage in a global crisis.
The public sector is in free fall, and I was quite surprised to see the Mail on Sunday columnist Peter Hitchens, bless him, giving a very good explanation of what's going on BBC Question Time last night.
The first thing we have to recognise in all these pay disputes is to ask the question, who's doing the pushing? Whose conditions have been changed by whom? And everybody in this country who's at work and paid at the moment is being pushed by inflation and a rising cost of living. The wages which they had 2 years ago are not the wages they have now. They're worth considerably less. And under those circumstances, people who have the power to try and get back some of what they've lost from inflation can be expected to do so, and the railwaymen are among us. I wish the minister would stop referring to train drivers and what they're paid. Obviously, they are part of the dispute, but most of the people who are taking part in it are not train drivers, and they aren't paid anything like that. And it's silly of him to keep saying that, because it muddies the waters. I don't know how best you can compromise. My own view of British governments and the railways has been for many years that it's the government which causes far more disruption to my twice daily travel on the trains than any union has ever done. The failure to maintain the ludicrous experiment of privatisation, which largely wrecked the railways, the constant track circuit failures, signal failures, and other things, which and currently I can't even get to work properly because a bridge has collapsed on my way to work. This is not a well-run, seriously invested service, and it's not taken seriously by the government, which runs a ministry for roads with railways tacked on. But I am not convinced that all justice in this is on the side of the government and the employers. And one of the reasons I'm not convinced of it is because people like the minister keep saying it's all about train drivers when it so patently isn't. People are facing, as I understand it, the actual compulsory loss of jobs.
No, they're not. No, that's
well, nobody
true.
Is all.
That's not
gone,
true.
That's gone completely.
There's no requirement for compulsory...
There's no compulsory redundancy.
No, but that one of the things that's been offered by the employers is no compulsory redundancies.
And,
so
that, and that's
when the union has said that there are going to be lots of job loss, that's simply not true.
So we're not going to see, for instance, as I'm told, lots of ticket office staff disappearing in the coming years.
No, the whole point
so
about...
So 5 years from now, when I go to my local station, there'll be the same ticket office staff as there are now.
No, the whole point about the ticket office staff is that only 12% of people buy tickets now from ticket offices.
So hang on,
we want the ticket office staff out of the ticket offices in the stations, properly able to support passengers.
But they'll still have jobs, is that what
Yes, but they just won't be sat in a ticket office not selling tickets to people. Most tickets are now sold online or from machines. People do not buy tickets from ticket offices. It's not how people do it anymore.
You're looking at someone who bought a ticket this morning at a ticket office.
But you're one of the 12%, Peter. 90%,
lots of people,
no, most people do not.
Lots of people prefer it, but it's part of the issue. I think that if you would just perhaps have been more concerned about running and creating and maintaining a decent railway service for the past 50 years, instead of trying to privatise it and shut it down and squeeze it in favour of roads, then I might take more seriously your concern for railway passengers. At the moment, I'm a little doubtful.
Okay. Let's take another question.
So that's Mark Harper, the Minister of Transport, Minister, replying to Hitchens there. Peter Hitchens, Mail on Sunday columnist. Martin, I mean, he's really rubbing it in there, saying, look, you know, you're running this railway into the ground. He's saying it's your fault, it's not the union's fault. And he's also saying, really, you're just a minister for roads. And if we look across at the profits that have been announced this week by BP and Shell, you can see why. Because, of course, as the railways start failing and being made to fail by people like Mark Harper, then these profits will be increasing all the time, won't they? For the energy companies.
Well, the profits are increasing because of the spot market and the international situation and all the rest of it. The running down of the railways, I think it's very significant. Somebody like Peter Hitchens, who's essentially a Tory journalist, is saying common sense things that anybody can see. And there's a clear majority in public opinion in this country that wants to renationalise the railways. And of course, we could easily have done it during the pandemic, because they had to be subsidised anyway. And at that point, you could have said, right, if we're going to subsidise you to get through this crisis, we're going to take you over at the end of it. And that's exactly what happened at the end of World War II. They took it over. We could have done that. But, of course, the Tory government isn't going to do that because the shareholders in the privatised railways, they're the funders of the Conservative Party.
Quarterly profits for Shell, £7.6 billion. That's profits, folk, not turnover, profits. And BP's £4 billion profits, fuelled by smart trading from their gas and oil trading teams.
Yes, in other words, they're speculating. What happens when you've got an international crisis like this is there's lots of money to be made speculating on the future price of oil and gas. And therefore, that's what you do. And if you're a big company like that, that's what you do.
Oil has dropped down to under £60 a barrel, which is half the £111 a barrel it was this time last year. But we haven't seen fuel prices halved, have we?
No, because what happens is they're able to profit when prices go up, and when prices go down, they don't have to pass that on to the consumer, so they don't. Of course, you know, they ought to be nationalised like Gazprom. You know, that's one of the reasons why inflation in Russia is low, is because they've got nationalised industries supplying things on long-term contracts.
Oh, well, I think if the government tried to privatise BP or Shell, BP or Shell, they might become a cropper in the courts, mightn't they?
Well, they would. I mean, what you need to do is regulate these monopolies where they're not making any money, and then their share price goes down, and then you take them over. Although, what you should do is not privatise them in the first place.
Well, BP might shut down and bulldoze their refineries or something.
Well, they could do. There's all sorts of problems that might occur. The thing is, if you've got a nationalised industry like British Petroleum used to be, or like Gazprom still is, don't privatise it, and then you won't have the problem of what to do. Because you see, any excess profits that were made, if it was a nationalised industry, and of course the nationalised Norwegian oil industry is making huge profits at the moment, and that especially with them helping to blow up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, they've just put a new pipeline into Poland, and they're going to make money on the back of it. But all that money goes to the national government in Norway. So they can use it to pay for pensioners to insulate their homes, nursery schools for their grandchildren, etc. And that's the way you do it. And if you do it like we do it, if you just end up with a criminal elite at the top making a fortune, and your economy is actually grotesquely inefficient. That's the real killer. It's not even efficient. It's inefficient.
Yeah, so the godfather of artificial intelligence warns of the dangers for humanity as he quits Google. A man widely regarded as the godfather of AI has warned of dangers ahead after resigning from Google. Dr. Jeffrey Hinton, 75 years old, well, it's quite a good time to retire, revealed he'd quit in a New York Times interview, and he said part of him now regrets his life's work. AI, Martin. Some people say actually AI doesn't even really exist. It's just machine learning, and it's not really the same thing.
Well, I mean, it's obviously that people are talking about it a lot at the moment because of the people like Elon Musk saying we need to, you know, suspend developing this until we understand the implications. It's clearly going to have some big implications. I mean, it could, for example, put out of work loads of professional people.
Well, he uses that SS trope, I console myself. If I hadn't done it, someone else would have.
Well, I think it's in the nature of the technology to move in this direction, isn't it? I mean, we've all lived through the last 20 years. People didn't used to have mobile phones. They literally just had landlines and going on knocking on people's doors and snail mail.
Born in Britain.
And now they haven't. And of course, that continues. That whole process doesn't end, does it?
Born in Britain, Dr. Hinton began work on an idea, a neural network, at Edinburgh University in 1972. Well, I can remember, wow, back in, 2000, one of the software engineers I knew saying, well, watch out for these neural nets. That's where the danger lies. Alongside his team, he's developed the neural nets to a point where they can learn to identify common objects in photos. So this is the sort of thing which facial recognition uses then, Martin, to sort of initially identify in a video picture or a still that there's a face that needs identifying, and then I suppose channeling that face to some bit of software somewhere to to try and identify who that person is.
Well, I think this is inherent in this technology. And, you know, in a way, it's quite bizarre because people go out of their way to buy the latest phones And they, you know, they're keen to have them, but of course it makes them targets for hacking and surveillance. And that you know, everything around us is electronic surveillance. And that's not going to change anytime soon, is it?
This today in the Mail, privacy fears over new AI speed camera, which uses 4D scanning. This is probably the technology this guy developed. To spy on drivers inside their cars, can detect motorists on mobiles or without seatbelts. The Red Speed Sentio, it's like Sentio, oh God, camera can catch motorists breaking the law inside the car. 10-inch cameras can detect whether too many people are also inside a vehicle. Privacy campaigners have raised warnings over this Big Brother-style AI speed camera. The 10-inch camera can detect whether too many people are in the car, as well as spotting those who are speeding or going through a red light. Well, I think there are cameras that can do that anyway, but this device has not yet got Home Office approval. No doubt it will do, because the Home Office approves everything evil. And Transport for London denied reports in The Sun it was already being trialled in the A23 in Lambeth. The camera can also be linked to databases from police forces and the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Agency to check vehicles are properly taxed and insured. So this is the world we're going. This is Big Brother, isn't it? Mass surveillance. So you've got a little kind of device sitting by the side of the road, and the motorist is fair game.
Well, I think everybody focuses on motoring because lots of people are motorists, and therefore they think this is, you know, this is going to affect them. But of course, the real danger of this technology is not dealing with traffic offences. It's actually political, that they'll be able to, you know, they'll know everything about, you know, people that they target.
So someone like Piers Corbyn or a political activist of some sort, they want to know exactly where they are.
Yeah, exactly.
Photographs of them everywhere, yes, tracking them around
in
real time.
But, yeah. And that, I mean, this was all pioneered in Northern Ireland years ago. The Glutton system used by the British Army was very, you know, it was an early version of all of this. And they knew the colour of the wallpaper in every Republican voting family's house, you know.
Yeah, the fact is that the police are increasingly using this sort of technology, according to this article, to catch criminals rather than actually, you know, going out and actually observing them and chasing them, pulling them over, that sort of thing. The idea is, oh, we've got a picture of you here, we're going to send you a letter, you better come to court or pay the fine.
Well, it's always been true that they're going to use
this. It's less human policing. It's policing by electronics.
Well, yes, but of course it means that if it depends whether it works or not. And it also depends what the laws are that you're enforcing. You know, if you believe, as I do, that drugs should be legalised, then this gives this police powers to do all sorts of things to try and disrupt what they regard as criminal markets. But of course it doesn't solve the underlying problem, which is the drugs shouldn't be illegal in the first place. Now, you know, most people are opposed to burglary, but is it going to help them catch burglars?
This is
the
sort of thing, you know? I suppose, which is going to be installed around London to try and stop people, or to fine people for driving in the ULEZ as they expand it out to the M25.
Yes,
but that in itself is very controversial.
Well,
the whole system was designed as a system of road pricing by the Siemens company, which was a Nazi company in the Second World War, and then took over British companies like Plessy, etc. And the whole system, if you have a look at it, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. A fascinating document just drawn up by Siemens, and the Mayor of London has just literally copied and pasted it into the London Mayor's headed paper, and that is his policy. It's not really his policy, it's Siemens' policy.
Well, I'm very concerned about the potential for this technology, Tony, which is what we're discussing in the wider way. But I think that people are obsessed with traffic issues when the real danger of this technology isn't to do with traffic. I mean, we want to get people out of their cars and into public transport, for example, which, of course, we're not doing.
But do you know what? As you go in and out of a supermarket, they've got the same sort of technology.
Well, that's right.
As you go in and out of a railway station, the same technology.
Yes,
there. As you go across a bridge, the same technology.
Yes,
there.
In other words, it's not just about motorists, is it?
Well, I think the reason it's being introduced as a motoring thing is because there's lots of money to be made through fining people.
Well, I mean, it may be that it's a money-making scheme by the Greater London Council, but then, of course, their budget has been cut by central government by millions and billions, and they've got to get the money back from somewhere. The same is true in Bristol, as you keep going on about the developers here. The central government grant to Bristol has been completely decimated, so they've then got to be entrepreneurial about how they're going to fund things going forward. forward. It's all wrong. We ought to have a stable public-private sector system with the public sector dominant and the private sector in its place. And we could have had that, but we haven't got it. It's perfectly feasible, but we didn't do it.
Back to the AI Google whistleblower, Dr. Hinton. He says it will be hard to prevent AI being co-opted for humans for personal gain, regardless. Well, this is what's going on here. So the Mayor of London and various other local authorities are saying, well, actually, if we put this stuff around, we can be fining people left, right and centre. This is a massive income stream for us. He says, this is Dr. Hinton that says this, it's hard to see how you can prevent the bad actors from using it for bad things. Expanding on those fears in an interview for the BBC, he added, you can imagine, for example, some bad actor like, and then they put in Russian President Vladimir Putin, decided to give robots the ability to create their own sub-goals. So, you know, you can have a targeting done by artificial intelligence. In fact, there was an article last Boxing Day in the Times, which then got taken off their website, saying that this is what Palantir was doing, exactly that. The idea was that Palantir, the software, had been programmed to estimate what the best targets were going to be for the Ukrainians and their NATO friends to be firing missiles at.
Well, this is much more to the point than worrying about traffic regulations.
Well, it's the beginning of it, isn't it?
Yes, I know.
And
this is
in your face as well as in a satellite over Ukraine.
Yeah, well, yes. Yes, of course, but the military use of this is becoming increasingly pertinent because, of course, the Russians have developed these robot tanks. I don't know if you've seen them, but, of course, there's lots of advantages to having a robot tank. Nobody gets killed if they get knocked out, for example. And I'm afraid we're in a very serious arms race now, but of course we're not winning because we privatised the production of military weaponry, and it turns out to be a highly inefficient system.
The Russians didn't. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Peter Hitchens again on BBC Question Time last night talking about this AI whistleblower.
Well, I think the internet is terrifying enough already, actually. It's perfectly possible to spread things which are not true and suppress things which are true in very effective ways, and almost anything which happened before about the turn of the century is very difficult to find out about at all. And for those whose lives have begun since the great change to the electronic world, they just simply can't find out what happened. So it is bad enough. And I think if someone as deeply involved in artificial intelligence as this person is ready to say, we've created a monster, it keeps me awake at night, I cannot sleep, I'm not sure what we've done, then we should be deeply worried. The thing which concerns me is I'm not at all sure that we know how to stop it now.
Which is the point he makes as well.
Yeah, we don't know how do we stop it. But I think the damage that's already been done by the electronic world is huge and very frightening. I find it worrying all the time. It's simply trying to both discover and get across information of a kind which the World Wide Web doesn't necessarily agree with. You feel a sort of force trying to prevent certain things being said, and a sort of force trying to prevent you finding out certain things, because it's got an opinion. And if that opinion becomes as solid as artificial intelligence will make it, then it's very dangerous.
Peter Hitchens on the BBC Question Time last night. I love his characterization there. You feel a sort of force trying to make you think a certain thing. Well, we've seen that this week, haven't we? Again, just as with the Nord Stream pipeline, Martin, apparently we're not supposed to even think that NATO and the Ukrainians could have tried to kill Vladimir Putin. What was actually happening was the Kremlin were attacking their own Kremlin.
Well, are we going to be moving on to discussing Russian affairs?
What we're talking about here is fake news, you know, isn't it?
I was just thinking when he was making those remarks, if you look at the pamphlets from the English Civil War, or the pamphlets that were written during the American Revolution, or the pamphlets that were written during the French Revolution, they were definitely not an objective analysis.
There was loads of black propaganda, wasn't there?
There was loads of black propaganda, and ultimately the Americans concluded in 1776 that there was to be no controls over freedom of speech, because ultimately it had a self-control mechanism in it. So if you read that something's just rubbish, but you can buy another pamphlet that completely disagrees with the first pamphlet, then that's freedom of speech. And the idea that you've got that there's more of this crazy stuff out there than used to be the case is simply not true. I mean, in the past, people had, you know, there was very little attempt to be objective in what people said. And the way in which it was supposed to be dealt with is through debate and people voting and deciding which things they wanted to do. Now, I don't see anything intrinsic about the internet that's any different from that. What it is different from is the previous era, like the 50s and 60s, where you've got dominant media companies giving people, you know, everybody watches the same news programs and so on. And of course, what the internet has done, it allows people, for example, to get their news by listening to our little podcast rather than just switching on news at 10. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The people who don't like that are the people who want to control what's said. And I'm very suspicious of these various attempts to control the internet, because it's actually, it's an attempt basically to stop people saying what they want to say.
So what we've had,
because they just don't like
what we've had since the creation of radio, and it's amazing really that there was so little celebration of the 100 years of the BBC last year. It's a pity really, because of course it's nothing to celebrate anymore. The idea that, you know, this is something which has gone through waves, a little bit like the economic situation. You've had decent economic conditions, decent paying conditions for workers, and that's gone up and down, just as the mass media has. Now, that's gone from initially from just newspapers, national newspapers, plus The Guardian up in Manchester, and obviously other newspapers in Glasgow and Edinburgh, to the I suppose it was called the Home Service initially, and then Radio 4, and that had a certain amount of freedom for a while. Then we had BBC Local Radio, which was, I remember someone telling me about how in the 1970s, how when BBC Local Radio first started, it was just like Bristol Community Radio used to be. Anyone could kind of walk in and have a chat, and that was, you know, that was the way it worked. And now it's much more controlled. The BBC is like a fortress here in Bristol. You know, you've got several layers of security to stop anyone getting anywhere near a microphone. The same then happened as happened with television, possibly to an even larger extent. And now that clampdown, Martin, seems to be happening on the internet too.
Well, I mean, the powers that be want to control what you think, especially in wartime. And the way, you know, things like the BBC are publicly funded indirectly, and they have at least in theory, an obligation to give an objective view of things and to give a full spectrum of opinions a fair go. But the private press, for example, has always been utterly partisan. Nobody expects Rupert Murdoch's newspapers to do anything than push Rupert Murdoch's agenda. And of course, that's possible, you know, and that's been the deal up to now, that the private sector can say whatever it likes, but the public sector has got to fulfill certain criteria. I would argue that you might want to have some rules and regulations for the internet, but those should also apply to the Daily Express. Now, if they're not going to apply to the Daily Express, I can't see why you've got to apply them on the internet. The internet is no different from the Daily Express. Anybody can say what they want, and if you don't like it, you can click on something else.
Well, we're looking at an economic cataclysm potentially coming down the line. We'll be talking a bit more about that with Tim Cohen at the end of the show. But thank you to whichever listener it was that sent in this article from the Salisbury Journal. Badger Cull, Wiltshire. Shocking figures reveal the true death toll. New figures has revealed that more than 2,983, that's 2,984, badgers were slaughtered across Wiltshire in 2022. So that's 3,000. This is a massive amount of badgers being killed. Across England, the death toll reached over 30,000 badgers. Martin, this is, I mean, we'll be hearing from Mark Purdy in a minute about his struggle to with the chemical industry, which is what's actually causing the problems with cows, not the badgers. They're not causing the problem. Yes, they have a bit of TB, maybe, but then they tend to get over it straight away. So his argument is, anyhow, that the TB in badgers has got nothing to do with TB in cows, that they just get it. It's because cows are given all these various treatments and chemicals, and their immune systems are vulnerable. So if you just stop giving them all these various chemicals and treatments, then they wouldn't be catching TB and you wouldn't have to kill these 30,000 badgers. What do you think is the real reason for this badger cull?
Well, it's lobbying by the National Farmers Union, isn't it? Let's face it, they're the ones who really
want
to...
And do they really represent farmers?
Well, they think they do.
They're an insurance company, aren't they?
Well, I mean, the Welsh Farmers Union split from the National Farmers Union in the 1950s because the interests of small farmers in Wales are not the same as those of bigger farmers in lowland England.
Yeah, and it's farmer, P-H-A-R-M-A, not farmer, as well, involved in all of this. Anyway, I mean, my own pet theory is, well, you know, that if there is an economic collapse, people are going to need, as we heard from Robert Kennedy last week, people are going to need to go into the natural environment to get their food. And if you've killed all the badgers in the country, or almost all of them, then you won't be able to eat badger anymore, because the badgers are actually quite a good staple provider of meat to keep you alive. And they don't, the powers that be don't want that. But it's also, I think, to do with bolstering the pharmaceutical industry and its massive amount of profit it makes from farming.
Well, the farming systems have been dominated by corporations for years, and gradually they've taken over what goes on. Now, we need complete land reform in this country and elsewhere, and we need to go back to more traditional techniques with land reform, meaning that everybody, many people will get a chance to be a small farmer. And that sounds like it's utopianism, but it isn't utopianism in countries like Brazil.
Well, we have things called smallholders, market gardens, smallholders, yes, this sort of thing.
Yeah, but if you want something like that, you've got to plan for it. The market won't provide it.
This is
if you want something like that, you've got to decide you want it, and you've got to make a plan to have it.
Supplement your food supply, isn't it, really? And also, it's a way into farming for people, but you see hardly any market gardens or small holdings around anymore.
Well, that's right, because of the corporatization. I mean, it's all dependent upon using, artificial fertilizers, pesticides, and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not particularly completely opposed to using artificial fertilizers. I think pesticides is another thing, because clearly they're poisonous, and you want to be minimizing your use of poisons for obvious reasons.
We've also heard this week that there's going to be an imposition in Holland of a scheme on the Dutch farmers so that private equity firms can buy up their farms if they can't afford to pay the nitrogen tax. So there's obviously a lot of activity and activism amongst Dutch people and Dutch farmers, but I thought it was all about carbon, zero carbon, but no, apparently nitrogen is
well, that's right.
Evil
so
stuff
the,
too
the
now.
People, there's a lot of confusion about this sort of thing, is that people think that it's all to do with the World Economic Forum's climate change agenda. In this case, it's talking about nitrogen. Now, in actual fact, intensive farming in Holland and in parts of Germany is actually quite destructive. I mean,
what about here?
Well, here, the chicken farmers in Wye Valley, where my parents live, have basically completely killed the river off in the last 10 years. They didn't do it before.
Well, isn't that just to do with the regulation? So
well,
they're
they
just discharging
allowed,
stuff
they
into the river.
They shouldn't have been allowed
this
to do
Fergal
it.
This is Fergal Sharkey territory,
yeah,
isn't
but it? Is. They shouldn't have been allowed to do it. They've been able to make a lot of money out of producing battery chicken, but of course the knock-on effects of that is it's destroyed the ecosystem of the Wye Valley, which at one stage, because my dad was on the council when the Wye Valley was the cleanest river in Europe, it got an award. It's now one of the dirtiest, and that's happened very, very quickly because basically people are making money short term without thinking of the long term. I mean, obviously the kind of people who are pushing back against this are the trout fishing industry, the people who allow that people pay to go and fish on the Wye, but the salmon are all dead because of all the muck in the river.
But this is quite serious, isn't it? The Dutch farmers are saying, well, we're going to have to take to the motorways again. They are basically being paid just to shut down and sell up their farms.
Well, the issue is, as far as I understand it, and I haven't looked into this too deeply, is that intensive farming of the kind that is done in Holland is actually quite destructive of things like the water
well,
table.
You just said that. Anyway, yeah. The EU has approved, I'll put a link up to the Telegraph article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, controversial Dutch farm buyout plan to meet nitrogen goals. So forget carbon, folks. The Netherlands has been given the go-ahead to start buying up thousands of farmers' businesses to meet the European Union mandate on climate goals. Under the £1.3 billion plan, entire farms located near near nature reserves will be purchased by the government, with hundreds more farmers compensated for losing their operations voluntarily, in inverted commas. It forms part of the Hague's wider strategy for slashing nitrogen emissions in half. I mean, if these farmers decided they wanted to go organic, Martin, maybe they would be able to stay in existence.
Well,
it's a big temptation.
I can't understand why. I mean, there may be issues with nitrogen, because I mean that's the issue in the Wye Valley, because all the nitrogen in the chicken poo is what's destroying the river. Now, it may be that there is an issue there. And, you know, they're saying, but around nature reserves, we don't want people using nitrogen.
So they're taxing them, basically, to drive them into debt. And then they're saying, oh, it's okay, we'll buy your farm up from you. Well, now, this is private equity. It's not the government buying up the farm.
Well, of course.
This is just a way of grabbing the land.
Yeah,
surely.
So in other words, it may be what your current situation may be where you don't want to be, but then you change it and you possibly make it worse. But I mean, what's got to happen with the chicken farms in the Wye Valley is they've just got to be told to stop doing it. That probably will push the price of chicken up, and that's what you'd expect.
Why don't they just pay them to go organic if there really is such a big problem?
The point is, if you were to create...
It's to get rid of the farmers, isn't it?
This is possibly development
land. There's all sorts of other things. They might want to grow trees on this. But the point is, Martin, this is a kind of... Well, it's not privatisation, because these are private individuals that own it. It's a robbery. It's a kind of official robbery of the land from the people who are managing it at the moment, handing it over to private equity.
Well, that is clearly what possibly is... That's possibly what's happening in the Netherlands. But don't forget, the real goal of the Common Agricultural Policy as originally conceived is to keep family farmers on the land, in France particularly. And, of course, the McSharry principles put forward by the Irish Commissioner for Agriculture was that we've got to get away from subsidising big farmers. And what we really want is lots of small farmers, so we should subsidise small farming, not farming in general.
It's very easy to do that. All you do is you have a cap on the subsidy, so that if you've got a bigger than a certain amount of farm, you don't get any extra subsidy.
Indeed. But you know what?
Well, they've done the opposite, haven't they?
Well, they've done the opposite.
So you don't subsidise the small farms, but you do subsidise the Queen. King Charles and the land there.
Yeah, but the McSharry principles have been generally accepted across Europe, but the British scuppered it. The British National Farmers Union. And they said, no, we don't want that because it disadvantages
British
farmers.
Well, they can't
British
do that
farmers.
Anymore. That's right.
So we've now got a situation where British agriculture is now going to be exposed directly to New Zealand and Australian competition.
I think what's going on here is pretty simple, actually. The EU is just facilitating the takeover of these individual family farms by private equity firms. Mostly, you know, you're looking at ultimately BlackRock, Vanguard, people like this that just want to own our world. And they're going to successfully do it, it looks like now, thanks to the European Union. Anyway, on a similar note, let's have a look at the coronation. What's your plans for tomorrow, Martin? You'll be sitting in with a beer watching the telly, or will you be down there waving a flag?
I don't really know. I haven't thought about it. I might listen to the concert in the cathedral, in the abbey, before it starts, because it looks as if that might be quite, you know, nice to listen to. But the actual thing itself, I shall probably, I shan't be participating as such.
And no street parties?
No.
No bunting?
I didn't go. Everybody was in school today and they were all wearing red, white and blue and crowns and things. And
kids came in wearing red, white
and
blue. Oh, right, they were asked to do that.
Yes.
Lovely. Well, that's actually quite nice, isn't it?
Well,
it's also mind-controlling those poor little kids into thinking this is something wonderful. But you're not a monarchist, are you?
No, but I was happy to, you know, participate in the sense that it's just a day of fun is how it's being presented. It does have its implications, of course it does. How do you think the establishment has managed to rule this country thousands of years? It's because they've spent a lot of time and energy making sure your brain has been filled with their stuff.
The schools have got no money for books, but they've got loads of bunting and crowns suddenly appeared. So what do you think is going to be a new chapter? King Charles III, now he's getting his coronation, and that's what Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer were saying at Prime Minister's Questions.
Well, I think what the death of the former Queen is the end of an era, because she was on the throne for so long. the longest reigning monarch. So that's the important thing. I mean, it could be that, you know, Charles isn't that young. He could be king for quite a short time, couldn't he? And then somebody else will be king. It's just, you know, these things are not really.
Well, Tim Cohen thinks he's going to have a global role. We shall see. But anyway, I mean, really, I like to remind people that he's actually a Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. He's not really a Windsor at all. They had to change their name, didn't they, in the First World War, because the Gotha bombers were bombing London, and it was thought not to be a good idea to have a Gotha king.
Well, the Zeppelins were bombing London in the First World War, weren't they? But the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas were a German family, as were the Hanoverians, who were the previous family. And, of course, Queen Victoria spoke fluent German, and she was married to a German. So, those links go back a long way.
Yes, and if you want to go right the way back to the some of the original Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, they were the ones that funded he was booted out of Ingolstadt University. Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Illuminati, he was picked up by a Saxe-Coburg-Gotha aristocrat and given given somewhere to live by that same family, bizarrely. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Neil Oliver talking about Charles. Last 3 years, he says, have changed everything.
These past 3 years, from the advent of the pandemic forward, have been years like no others for most people alive today. People of a certain advanced age can remember war and other horrors, but for most people alive, the last 3 years have changed everything. You know, they have altered the very fabric of society, and people have been put through so much. There's the practicalities like the cost of lockdown, the catastrophic damage that was inflicted upon business and therefore on the economy. There's the emotional and physical hit of the pandemic, the consequences of lockdown, the isolation of lockdown, the shutting of schools, the shutting of clubs and theatres and restaurants and shops and all of the rest of it. UK living standards are as low or lower than they have been since the 1950s. You know, dying people are on waiting lists for cancer treatment and all of the rest of it. I've looked at figures like 1 in 9 of the population are on the waiting list for some or other treatment for their failing health. And I think about that context and wonder, open-mouthed, that King Charles is taking the steps that he's taken. And it's not just about the homage to the people. What really troubles me about Charles and makes me ask questions about the constitutional monarchy that apparently we live in is that he has supported net zero and all that it means for his subjects, which is to say zero carbon, which is to say the rapid withdrawal of fossil fuels, and everything that goes along with Agenda 2030 or Agenda 25 or whatever notional date they've put on completing this revolution, what all of that means for Charles's subjects, I really think ought to make him think again. I mean, put quite simply, many, many of his subjects are choosing between eating and heating at a time while he continues to be supportive of the concept of net zero that's pushed by the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization and the United Nations and all of the rest of it. He pushes the contentious politics of net zero, and millions of us don't agree with those politics, and therefore it is wrong for the constitutional monarch to pick a side. People are for, people are against. And the constitutional monarch should not be taking a side, which means by definition that he becomes an opponent to some part of his population. It's wrong. I say all the time, not just about Charles, all these people that are interfering with our lives at every level, what kind of cars we can drive, how we can heat our homes, whether we should eat meat or switch instead to plant-based diets and powder made from insects. All of these people that are pushing and coercing these novel approaches to how we live our lives, I say, who do they think they are? Who do these people think they are, inviting themselves to interfere in our lives in the way that they do? I've said it before and I'll say it again. Net zero, which King Charles and others support, is a suicide note being written on behalf of millions, if not billions, of people. And people will die as a direct result of the proposed withdrawal of fossil fuels and this so-called switch to renewables and a whole other swathe of alternative ways of living. I mean, let's just look at fossil fuels for a minute. At least 80% of all the energy upon which we depend comes from fossil fuels. We're not adopting renewables. There's not a naturally inclined switch. We're being coerced. We're being left with no option but to accept energy from renewables. And renewables don't offer an alternative to fossil fuels. Not at all. They certainly don't at the moment. And no rational mind thinks that they will offer that alternative at any time in the foreseeable future.
Well, that's Neil Oliver speaking this week. Martin, his basic point is really to do with, you know, should Charles be weighing in on these political issues? I think the reason he thinks this one, the net zero, is so such a contentious one is actually it's going to be setting people back in their living standards such an enormous amount. At least that's what he says. And this isn't something that the head of state really should be seen to be doing. His mum, wasn't he, Liz, was making quite a lot of money out of things like offshore wind power, things like the generation from the seabed of tidal power. And she was making a bit of money, but she wasn't, at least like Charles is, an international campaigner on these issues saying you've got to do this.
Well, what would I say about this? We shouldn't have a constitutional monarchy. We should have a constitution. That's what we really need. And that's what most other countries have got in Europe, for example. They've got a written constitution. We don't have one. Now, because there is no written constitution, there isn't really any constitutional convention around any of this. The previous kings and queens of England were definitely political. Queen Victoria was definitely
a Tory. But Charles can't do what he wants, can he?
Well, he can't, and he can have these opinions, and they obviously have some influence in some quarters, but he's not going to determine the policy, because he can't. And, of course, the real problem I see with net zero is it ain't going to happen. So all the scaremongering about it, it ain't going to happen. The reason it ain't going to happen is because we're at war with Russia and China, and they're not going to agree to any of this, it's not going to happen.
A few years ago, I think it was around about 2015, when King Charles came out and said that Putin was the new Hitler.
Isn't it? Does Neil Oliver want to pick up on that?
Well, maybe he will do. Yes, who knows? Well, anyway, I mean, he can pick up on whatever he wants, Martin. Maybe we can pick up on it instead. We don't have to think exactly like Neil Oliver, do we? We can just talk about him, discuss him. The whole idea of that was I actually put it in an article saying Prince Charles strikes another blow for the British Republic. Do you think he's going to be such a controversial figure that perhaps he will precipitate a republic in Britain?
Well, the Prime Minister of Belize this week said that they're going to have a referendum, or that's possibly not a referendum in their parliament, and they're going to vote to get rid of the monarchy. Yeah. And of course, when we're talking about the British monarchy, he is the head of state of a number of different countries around the world. But of course, many of these countries are not interested in Britain's position over things like the war in Ukraine.
A lot of what was going on
there. And therefore, they're going to change. In Jamaica, for example, they're talking in terms of getting rid of the monarchy.
Yeah, a lot of them are. And so this is what I'm saying, exactly what I'm saying, is that maybe Charles will make that happen even more quickly. Maybe that's partly his role, is to, you know, dissolve the monarchy. But anyway, much of what's happening today was really cooked up around about 1995. That was when it finally became obvious through the Diana interview that the marriage has completely broken down, and the Queen wrote to both Diana and Charles saying you must get a divorce. At that time, there was the 1995 Diana interview, and because of course she is the elephant in the room up at the Abbey, or the elephant in the Abbey, as I said a few weeks ago. So let's have a listen now to an interview between Jonathan Dimbleby did with Prince Charles, as he was at the time, about the breakup of the marriage, and also having been followed round by paparazzi.
I always think there's a camera now. always, or something like a camera, and worse. I mean, it is extraordinary how now you feel, I do anyway, that wherever you are, there's somebody hiding behind something, somewhere. And with these immense cameras now, with these huge lenses and magnification, you can sit, you know, a mile away, quite happily, and photograph through windows and everything else. And they do.
Until now, the prince has not spoken about the collapse of his marriage. No friend has been permitted to speak on his behalf. As a result, it has been put about that he was always unfaithful, even before the marriage died in the latter half of the 80s.
The most damaging charge that is made in relation to your marriage is that you were, because of your relationship with Camilla Parker Bowles, from the beginning, persistently unfaithful to your wife, and thus caused the breakdown. What is your response to that persistent criticism?
That's the persistent criticism, is it? Well, I... And the trouble is, you see, that these things, again, as I was saying earlier, are so personal. It's difficult to know quite how to, you know, to talk about these things in front of everybody, and obviously I don't think many people would want to. But I mean, all I can say is that there's been so much speculation, feeding on every other kind of speculation, that it all becomes bigger and bigger. I mean, all I can say is there is no truth in so much of this speculation. And Mrs. Parker Bowles is a great friend of mine. I have a large number of friends. I'm terribly lucky to have so many friends who I think are wonderful and make the whole difference to my life, which would become intolerable otherwise. And she has been a friend for a very long time, and along with a lot of other friends, and will continue to be a friend for a very long time. And I think also, most people probably would realize that when marriages break down, awful and miserable as that is, that so often, you know, that it is your friends who are the most important and helpful and understanding and encouraging. Otherwise, you would go start raving mad. And that's what friends are for.
Understandably, when your marriage collapsed, you form close friendships, you re-establish close friendships of whatever character that friendship is. Did you try to be faithful and honourable to your wife when you took on the vow of marriage?
Yes, absolutely.
And you were?
Yes. Until it became irretrievably broken down. Us both having tried.
You've been very open about all of this and what you've said. Do you now hope that this issue and expect this issue to go away? Is that what you hope will now happen?
Well, it would be nice if it did. From everybody's point of view. I mean, I don't think many other people have to go through this constant attention, not just me, but others, you know, when their marriages break down. I mean, as I've said before, it is a deeply regrettable thing to happen. But it does happen, and unfortunately, in this case, it has happened. I mean, it's the last possible thing that I ever wanted to happen. I'm not a total idiot. I'm unaware of all these problems, and as I was saying before, this business of predicting what everybody would say, it's not something that I went into marriage, you know, with the intention of this happening, or in any way in a cynical frame of mind. I mean, I'm honest, on the whole, not a cynical person, and you know, I'm self-righteous to say so, but I have, on the whole, tried, I think, to get it right. I mean, constantly people scrutinizing. So, I mean, I have always tried to get it right and tried to do the the right thing by everybody.
Well, I wonder if Dinah was still around, would she would agree with what he's saying there. Yeah, so is that what people are saying, he says, that you were sleeping with Camilla before and during the marriage to Dinah? And he denies it, Martin.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he, in the immortal words of Mandy Rice Davis. I do have some sympathy for him because people form relationships. You can imagine he's put under pressure. He's got to marry some suitable young lady. And of course she was, you know, Diane was then kind of chosen and of course it wouldn't have done for him to marry Camilla Parker Bowles, who was already married to Andrew Parker Bowles, and they've formed a relationship. He couldn't do that. And you can see that, you know,
so he's got a relationship going with Camilla, but he's got to have a sort of public wife.
Yes.
Now this is a very bad way to treat Diana, isn't it? She didn't necessarily
understand. Obviously she's not going to be very happy. She's not going to be very happy about that. She wasn't very happy about that. But of course back in the day, Edward the VII had an official wife and loads of mistresses.
Well, one of them,
as everybody
glad
always
you
did.
Mentioned that,
you know,
one
that
of
was
them,
just normal stuff in those circles.
One of them was called Alice Keppel. That's Camilla's ancestor. She was mistress to King Edward the VII. Prince Charles's great great grandfather and Camilla's great great grandmother were an item.
Yes, well, I mean, this used to be the case in royal and aristocratical circles, and that you had to get married for dynastic and other reasons, but once you'd done that and you produced a legitimate heir to inherit whatever it was, you know, there was a generally laissez-faire attitude to people forming relationships outside
marriage.
That was
never going to work in the internet age, really, was it?
Well, it's not going to... It would have worked. It worked in the...
Diana had decided to go along with it. She wasn't going to do that.
Yeah, well, exactly. But what's happened here is what you might call the bourgeoisification of the monarchy, where they've got to have a bourgeois lifestyle where they do not have sex outside marriage. Whereas, of course, traditionally, aristocrats and others, kings, royalty, had an open double standard about these things, and everybody accepted it.
Well, I mean, most of the public didn't know anything about it. It was only the upper echelons of the aristocracy, they
understood that it was going on. I mean, I understand that Anne Boleyn, I've just been reading about her, she was offered in French the possibility of being the chief mistress of the king, which would have been a great honour if she'd been the French court. But she dug her heels and said, no, I want to be married. And therefore, that's what Henry had to do. He wanted to have her as a mistress, but she wasn't having that. And that's why he had to...
She dug her heels in.
Yeah, she dug her heels in.
So we've heard from Charles. Now, obviously, we've got to hear from Diana too, from the famous Bashir interview, which has been banned. The BBC apparently have said no one is ever allowed to show it again, which is, well, I mean, it's paranoid, isn't it? And it's a sort of paranoia that's been coming out of the Prince Charles, King Charles camp for quite a while now. Also, the sanctioning of Martin Bashir, who did a fantastic, one of the best interviews the BBC's ever done, but it wasn't what King Charles wanted to hear. So let's have a listen now to Princess Diana speaking in that famous Martin Bashir interview in 1995 on Panorama about her thoughts on Charles becoming king.
But you would know him better than most people. Do you think he would wish to be king?
There was always conflict on that subject with him when we discussed it. And I understood that conflict because it's a very demanding role, being Prince of Wales, but is equally a more demanding role being king. And being Prince of Wales produces more freedom now, and being king would be a little bit more suffocating. And because I know the character, I would think that the top job, as I call it, would bring enormous limitations to him. And I don't know whether he could adapt to that.
Do you think it would make more sense, in the light of the marital difficulties that you and the Prince of Wales have had, if the position of monarch passed directly to your son, Prince William?
Well, then you have to see that William's very young at the moment, so do you want a burden like that to be put on his shoulders at such an age? So I can't answer that question.
Would it be your wish that when Prince William comes of age, that he were to succeed the Queen rather than the current Prince of Wales?
My wish is that my husband finds peace of mind, and from that follows other things, yes.
So that's Diana. She was killed in a car crash in 1998, but there she was speaking in 1995, speaking out, most definitely having her say on the BBC. Martin, what do you make of that? I mean, she's, in a way, it's quite prophetic listening to that, isn't it? She's saying, in fact, what she's saying is absolutely true, and it's been borne out by the circumstances that Charles is way too political to be a traditional head of state. He wants to weigh in on all subjects.
Well, if you've got a hereditary monarchy, then you have to just take who the hereditary monarch turns out to be. I don't believe in hereditary monarchy. This is one of the problems with it. Even if you've got good King Alfred, you've then also got Ethelred the Unready. And that's the problem with that way of choosing leaders, isn't it? And you can say, he is a constitutional monarch, but we don't really have a constitution. So there's nobody to tell him what he can and can't do, because there are no rules about it.
Yeah, but he's, for example, he's been basically put back in his box, wasn't he? He was telling the Church of England that, oh, he wants to have a multi-faith service. They've said, no, you can't do that.
Well, I'm not sure what happened there, but I'm sure that tomorrow he will, as I confidently predicted, promise to protect the faith, which is the Anglican faith in which I am confirmed. And there is no other kind of Christianity, Tony, as you well know. The Anglicans are the Christians, yeah. And like you Quakers are not Christians. Like you're Orthodox. Heretics.
I know, we're nonconformists, mate.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Anyway, so let's have a listen now to another little clip from Diana. And Bashir asks her, will she be queen?
Do you think you'll ever be queen?
No, I don't. No.
Why do you think that?
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts, in people's hearts. But I don't see myself being queen of this country. I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into. Because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
Why do you think they've decided that?
Because I do things differently. Because I don't go by a rule book. Because I lead from the heart, not the head. And albeit that's got me into trouble in my work, I understand that. But someone's got to go out there and love people and show it.
And do you think that because of the way you behave, that's precluded you effectively from becoming queen?
Yes, not precluded me, I wouldn't say that. I just don't think I have as many supporters in that environment than I did. Yeah.
You mean within the royal household?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They see me as a threat of some kind. And I'm here to do good. I'm not a destructive person.
Why do they see you as a threat?
I think every strong woman in history has had to walk down a similar path, and I think it's the strength that causes the confusion and the fear. Why is she strong? Where does she get it from? Where is she taking it? Where is she going to use it? Why do the public still support her? When I say public, you go in and do an engagement and there's a great many people there.
So that's another clip from the 1995 marvellous interviewing. I mean, really, really brilliant piece of interviewing by Bashir there. Why? You know, just getting her to answer, put the flesh on the bones of what she's saying. And, you know, of course, you know, she's quite right. She never was going to be queen. But saying also that the establishment is, I mean, basically she was ostracised, wasn't she? She wasn't the right person. She's produced these two kids. Now let's just get rid of her.
Well, she obviously didn't fit in and was very unhappy in the role. And, of course, you know, she probably wouldn't have been queen if she was divorced from Prince Charles, because she's no longer his wife. So I suppose that would have solved that problem. I think the whole thing is, it's an anachronism. And as you suggested earlier, Tony, it may be that before the end of King Charles's reign, we come to the conclusion that we need to get rid of that, because we probably need to create a new constitutional settlement, both in the what's left of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth. And we're not going to do that until we've had a massive crisis. But we're going to get a massive crisis.
One of the most controversial relationships King Charles has ever had is with a guy called Jimmy Savile. And he's the most prolific paedophile in Britain's history. He was also a BBC presenter. And, in fact, he penned a document which was the press advice for the royal household. I mean, this is quite incredible, isn't it, that somebody like Savile can be so pally with King Charles. Now, this is the ultimate question here, Martin, is to what extent do you think Prince Charles, as he was then, was conned by Savile, and Savile just managed to get close to him? Because there is form. There's quite a few people involved, for example, with the Prince's Trust, who've been prosecuted for paedophilia, not least of which is the Bishop Ball of the Gloucester Cathedral, the Gloucester's Bishop. He was a paedophile, and Charles was writing letters in his support. And the other thing that's come out this week, I didn't see this for a while, it's a story about Bill Oddie saying that the only reason the BBC allowed Jimmy Savile to continue, even though they knew he was abusing kids, was because he had the support of Prince Charles.
Well, I think that the paedophile networks surrounding Savile, I suspect, lead back into MI5 and MI6. Now, you can imagine that they take the deep state, if you like, takes manipulating this kind of level of interaction quite seriously, and the royal family will not be above that, the politics of that. The way that the security state uses the crown as being there—that's who they are responsible to.
So do you think maybe
Savile
was entrapping Prince Charles?
I think so. I mean, this is the point: is that the people like him are infiltrated in, like Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, who used to hang around with Prince Andrew and all the rest of it. But the point is that the networks surrounding the royal family also include lots of other powerful people, and those people are the ones that they need to blackmail if they want to keep control.
Parasiting on the powerful. Anyway, I had a chat to Valerie Sinison earlier this week. She was quoted by the Daily Express in the famous Jimmy Savile's satanic abuse story that they did when he was exposed. And she, I think, had some very interesting stuff to say about this whole idea of satanic ritual abuse, which she has dealt with many, many times as a psychiatrist, and also her lack of respect for Private Eye magazine, who just poo-pooed the whole thing and said it never happens.
There's someone that loved Private Eye from my teens onwards and saw them as libertarian. It was so disappointing to think there was a little enclave in this otherwise radical paper that had got this very strong view and was peddling it whenever they could. And it wasn't open to question. And it then made me worry about some of the news items that I'd thought they provided that were true. Could I trust what they were writing about anymore? Very disappointing. There were several important things you said there. Saying this will never happen again is such a dangerous sentence, because everything does happen again, and the NSPCC trying to say we're going to stop abuse forever. Well, abuse has gone on ever since there were people, and will carry on probably until we've wiped ourselves out of the planet. What we slowly hope for is that there's more understanding of what leads to traumatic behaviour being repeated. But it does happen again. And having a great big look at something that's in the news all the time gives people an illusion they've done the work. One, they only did it after he died. The terror of working with somebody that is part of the establishment is absolutely huge, and which is why VIP abuse of any kind is so difficult. It was Tebbit who really spoke very honestly when thinking about Cyril Smith and how police and all sorts of groups knew Cyril Smith was assaulting children sexually and physically. And yet there was this feeling that a disturbed child was dispensable against the reputation of government. And if we see the treatment that Tom Watson has had, or the treatment that the fantasist Nick has had, Carl Beach, where somebody who lied, and we don't know very much about his own trauma history, but in which a fantasist gets a longer prison sentence than a murderer because he named well-known people. And then suddenly all the press stop asking about him. And I think the same thing happens when someone has been found to be guilty after death, Jimmy Savile and Cyril Smith, and you see all the guilt by association and the level of turning a blind eye and the way the press get brave after the event, but then shut up any further exploration of it. People that want to frighten children have used fake belief systems, exaggerated aspects of them, in order to frighten children in all history and internationally. So that, yes, sometimes if we don't meet the perpetrator, if we're just meeting the way they have imprinted their rules, their actions on their victims, we are not getting the whole picture. So I don't know, out of all the children and adults I've met who have said that they were victims of Satanist abuse, how many of those perpetrators, alleged perpetrators, really were Satanists, and how many have made rituals to frighten children. But if it's alive in the victim and is carried by them like a daily nightmare, that's the thing we're working with, that we have to deal with.
That's Valerie Sinison, and it's interesting, I think, Martin, her take on this. What do you make of the this use of this whole idea of ritual abuse, satanic or otherwise, to really just scare the kids?
Well, a lot of child abuse doesn't involve ritual in that way. It's just what it is. That's the first thing.
But it seems to be the best way to scare the children.
Well, no. The ritual abuse is going to is often more organised.
Okay. So, and why do private eye deny it exists? This is again and again they say this. This is just rubbish. It doesn't happen.
I thought the lady speaking there was quite careful in what she was saying there, because she was saying that satanic abuse. I'm willing to accept that it exists, but as she said, some people are genuinely Satanists, and some of them are just using Satanism as a means to abuse
the
children.
The point is, I mean, Private Eye doesn't seem to really be doing its job, and maybe it's been infiltrated, God knows, but it doesn't. The idea that they're saying this doesn't happen has been, being very detrimental to actually getting anything done about it. I mean, in another part of the interview, she's saying, well, she doesn't think that there's been any dent really made in child abuse since the Savile story came out.
Well, child abuse has been going on in our society for many, many years. It's still going on now. We come across it in schools every day. It's definitely there.
Okay, and
But the elite child abuse involving rituals is something else, because that is linked to the deep state and the deep state's need for control of society.
How is it, do you think, that Savile managed to mesmerise Charles so much? I mean, even to the extent where Savile is writing his press advice for his entire royal operation. You do have to wonder whether Charles has completely got a tin ear there.
Well, he's not that bright. None of them are. None of them would be classified as in the A stream. He did.
Maybe rather like Jimmy Savile's sort of sense of humour or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, Jimmy Savile basically flattered him. Mm. Jimmy Savile used to be a miner.
Well, this is
Jimmy
worrying.
Jimmy Savile's a man of the people.
Martin, you've just got to the sort of point where I was heading, which is the idea of surrounding yourself by sycophants. This is no good thing for a ruler, is it?
Well, yeah, but that's what happens with hereditary monarchies in historical terms.
Well, sometimes it does.
What about Piers Gaveston?
The interesting thing about monarchy is every now and again, though, it throws up someone that gives a damn, doesn't it? Well, and there's nothing you can do to get rid of them.
Well, it just depends, doesn't it? I mean, you know.
It's much more of a sort of roll of the dice, a monarchy, rather than your kind of Republican system, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, that doesn't mean that alternative systems aren't open to abuse. Of course they are. Any system's open to abuse, let's face it.
Anyway, good old Valerie has done a book, as I said at the start of the show. It's called The Orpheus Project. It's literally just out. And in it, she explains what, you know, what the Sphinx books just published this year. She explains why she's written a novel, because it's the best way to get some of the facts out to help people to understand the way that satanic ritual abuse and other forms of abuse of children actually works, particularly with regard to powerful VIPs.
It is out. It is actually just out. It's called The Orpheus Project, and it's published by Sphinx Books. And the point of it was to try and educate through a novel, educate people as to what is going on. So the actual narrative is about a young woman with Down syndrome who is the heroine, who says she's been abused by the deputy prime minister and a rock star. And it's what happens in an ordinary National Health Service unit when somebody says something like that, and it follows her story. She also is from an aristocratic family, and so there are issues around the meaning of the abuse in that context, and it gets into my idea around where some of these perpetrator groups come from. So I'm hoping, in turning fact into fiction, the people in it are from my imagination, but what they're doing is from what I know from the people I've met.
One thing we haven't mentioned is the intelligence services and Epstein, because one of the things certainly I'm convinced is that the intelligence services do run some of these abuse rings, the idea being that politicians or people of influence are brought in, they're compromised in these abuse rings, filmed, photographed, etc., and that's used for blackmail. So what do you make of that?
I think that is highly likely, that any such group involved with power has got its unorthodox methods. And one of the things that I have been noting with VIP abuse is you can get sex slaves that have been forced to go to parties and smile and look happy. So some poor sod who is behaving badly to women in terms of having an anonymous relationship with anybody without bothering to think about their background. However, some of the men that go to these parties would have no reason to believe it was a sex slave having to have sex with them, that they've been brought up to feel they are their privilege, their wealth, makes them the most coveted person, and like a rock star with fans, they are not yet at this moment questioning who are these women. So some of the tragedy of the women used by Epstein like that is that they weren't looking beaten up, bruised in a way that a decent man, albeit having questionable sexual habits, could think, oh my goodness, what's happened to this woman? So this issue of blackmailing through a traumatized sex slave who knows they have to be smiling and faking it or they'd be damaged, this is carrying on, not just in the UK.
So that's Valerie Sinison there, and her book is The Orpheus Project, published by Sphinx Books this year, 2023. What do you make of her analysis of the intelligence links to this abuse, Martin?
Well, she's clearly aware of the possibility of it, but she doesn't come at it from that angle. I think that, and of course it's quite possible, as she says, that people go to, you know, parties, sex parties or whatever, and they do not think that these people that they're engaged with are being abused, but they could well be. But of course, there's all sorts of techniques that different organisations, including intelligence services, would use to entrap people. And it's if you read Whitney Webb's stuff about Epstein, it's all, you know, it all links back to in the US to the mafia and their techniques of social control, which were adopted wholesale by the CIA. So, you know, this the elite abuse is very much linked to power and blackmail, and she of course is aware of that, but she doesn't, for example, think she wouldn't mention something like the King Cora Boyce home scandal because it probably doesn't appear on her radar in the same kind of way it does for
me. I mean, this does imply that there's complicity between Charles and Savile rather than it just being some sort of coincidence.
Well,
doesn't it
may well be it could be either complicity or it could be that Charles is just basically being a chump, but either way he's compromised, and that's the point, isn't it? They're all compromised in one way or another. So, I mean, what's extraordinary about Savile is that, now he's dead, everything's been dumped on him, but that doesn't mean that we really understand what happened there. Nobody's asking any questions apart from this sort of thing we're doing here.
Well, I think they are, actually. At some point, this is going to get dealt with. Maybe not sooner rather than later, but the idea that you've got somebody who was so very close to Savile, now just about to take over is rather concerning. Anyway, I thought just to lighten up at the end, I thought, well, let's have a little bit of Spike Milligan, his take on King Charles, or when he was Prince Charles. And this is an extract from the BAFTA Lifetime Achievement Awards, which Spike Milligan got back in 1994. And Prince Charles tried to muscle in on it a little bit, and I think he probably regrets doing that.
I was going to say, about bloody time. As the TV companies have not employed me for 10 years, I will take that as a golden handshake. I'm not going to thank anybody, because I did it all on my own.
That's right. I have someone to thank him off. Before you guys go, Spike, I'm sure everyone knows that you have fans from all walks of life, and of course there's one very famous, very well-respected fan in particular who wanted to be here, couldn't be here, but wanted to send a message.
These are
you.
A series of clichés, you know.
that's my job this evening. Here we go, I have a letter to read out here from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales.
Do I kneel down for this?
I'm in enough trouble already, I'm not going to say a word.
And the Prince of Wales.
The Prince of Wales. I'm sorry I have to do this, but I know it takes a lot of impact out of it, but here we go. As someone who grew up to the sounds of the Goon Show on the steam-driven wireless, I must confess that I've been a lifelong fan of the participants in the show, and particularly of Spike Milligan.
Oh, the little grovelling bastard.
Well, I can't just call you man.
You could say Dennis.
I didn't know you were called Dennis.
Well, you didn't bother to find out, did you?
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you looked...
What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior.
Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice.
And how do you get that, eh?
By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma, which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society. If there's ever going to be any progress...
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here. Oh, how'd you do?
How'd you do, good lady? I'm Arthur, King of the Britons. Whose castle is that?
King of the who?
The Britons.
Who are the Britons?
Well, we all are. We are all Britons. And I am your king.
Oh, didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship. A self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working classes...
Oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
That's what it's all about. If only people would... Please, good people, I am in haste. Who lives in that castle?
No one lives there.
Then who is your lord?
We don't have a lord.
What?
I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Order? Who does he think he is?
I am your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings.
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony.
Be quiet!
Oh, but you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Shut up!
Oh, but if I went round saying I was an emperor just because some moistened bint had lobbed a scimitar at me, they'd put me away.
Shut up! Will you shut up?
Ah, now we see the violence inherent in the system.
Shut up!
Oh, come and see the violence inherent in the system! Help! Help! I'm being repressed!
Bloody peasant!
Oh, what a giveaway. Did you hear that? Did you hear that, eh? That's what I'm on about. Did you see him repressing me? You saw it, didn't you?
So, yes. And before we go into our musical break, an ode to Charlie Sausage Fingers, a.k.a. Charlie Bonkers, the man who would be king. Charlie is stomping, pomping at play. I am the king of circumstance. Hear him say... Iron my undies and cashmere socks, boil my eggs rapid and lop off their tops. Free range or else, he screams to his staff. Straight face they listen. Out of sight, they just laugh. A man with much power and money we see. Secrets all dark behind, only he knows his true calling. Perhaps out of hand, power gone to head. Christianity now banned. A man with no scruples when it comes to his needs, the environment, his calling, in love with the weeds. Wind farms and crops GM modified, he thinks. If his way is forward, our land will be jinxed. Pals with old Swabby from the WEF mob. A king for all seasons, not the man for the job. Many reasons for treason if he continues to plot. Bonkers, Charlie Wonkers. King of kings, he is not.
Onward, Christian soldiers, marching us to the war. With the cross of Jesus going on before. Christ the royal master is against the foe. Forward into the
the boom-a-lack-a, zoom-a-lack-a, wee. But there isn't any roar when the clock strikes four. Everything stops for tea. Oh, a lawyer in a courtroom, in the middle of an alimony plea, has to stop and help him pour when the clock strikes four. Everything stops for tea. It's a very good English custom, though the weather be cold or hot. When you need a little pickup, you'll find a little teacup will always hit the spot. Oh, the soldiers may be fighting in the trenches or a battleship at sea, but there isn't any war when the clock strikes four.
Knock it!
Everything stops for tea.
Oh.
So that's 1992, Usura, Open Your Mind. Before that, we had is it Mario Harp and his Rhythmics? Everything Stops for Tea, 1938, I think, or 37, that was. And before that, the Choir of Guildford Cathedral, Onward Christian Soldiers. And before that, the wonderful Patrizia Opulenza, with Ode to Charlie Sausage Fingers. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin, let's just look at this, the drone attack on the Kremlin. Unbelievable, really, that we're now getting the Western press, butter wouldn't melt in its mouth, telling us that the Russians are attacking themselves. Suddenly, the Western press have discovered something called a false flag operation, and now this is what the Russians do. They destroy their own Nord Stream pipelines, and now they try to kill Putin and attack the Kremlin.
Funnily enough, the Ukrainian Postal Service announced soon after the attack that they were going to issue a commemorative stamp showing the Kremlin with the missile hitting it, even though Zelensky claims that they've nothing to do with it. And at the same time, he went off to Finland and various other countries, so that if Russians were to retaliate, he wouldn't be anywhere near his normal bailiwick. And the US have claimed that they don't know anything at all about it, and it's not, they're not to blame, etc. But of course, the assassination of Alexander Dugin's daughter, the killing of this guy in the St. Petersburg cafe, the various attacks that were carried before the, the so-called raid into Russian territory where they killed three locals. The Ukrainians want to do these things, but they then, you know, the same thing with the attack on the Kerch Bridge in which three civilians died. They claimed it was nothing to do. They claimed that they cheered about it. They issued a commemorative stamp, and then they claimed it was nothing to do with them. Now, if people can't see what's wrong with all of this, I can't explain it to them. Now, I don't think the Russians are going to overreact here, but it's quite possible that they might decide that if the British were had a hand in it and British Special Forces, that a drone might arrive at number 10 Downing Street just to break the windows like the IRA did in 1991.
Well, we do know the United States is quite into its drone attacks. They've been doing this sort of thing in Yemen. They've been doing them in Pakistan. They've been doing them all over the world, virtually, based on the based from the Ramstein base, as Glenn Greenwald famously revealed, in Germany as their main drone control base. Russia on Thursday said the United States was behind the drone attack that targeted the Kremlin, which Moscow said was an attempt on Russian President Vladimir Putin's life. We know very well the decisions to carry out such actions, such terrorist attacks, are made not in Kyiv. Rather, it is precisely in Washington, said Dmitry Peskov. He added that often, even the targets themselves are not determined by Kiev, just by Washington. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova made similar comments. First and foremost, the creators and handlers of the Kiev regime, who hail from Washington, London and NATO, bear overall responsibility for everything that it's perpetrating, she wrote on Telegram. The comments drew denial of involvement in the drone attack from the White House. I can assure you there was no involvement by the United States in this, said National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
Well, to repeat Mandy Rife Davis, they would say that, wouldn't they? And
fake news?
Well, they're just making stuff up. I mean, they I think the point of this stuff is because they're actually, you know, it's actually a pretty stupid kind of attack. It was never going to do anything other than create a bit of an incident.
Well, I noticed Zelensky was saying, oh, we never attacked Russia. Well, apparently they have been attacking quite a lot of Russian soil.
Yes, they have. They have indeed been attacking.
Using these high miles missiles.
Yes, that's right.
Americans,
and it looks likely to me that this drone didn't come from Ukraine. It's been fired from inside Russia. But the British in particular have been developing stay-behind networks inside Russia, Tony. Would you believe that? And that they're being activated.
So you reckon this may have been fired from within Moscow somewhere?
Yeah, well, it'll probably be fired from something like 10 or 20 kilometres away from the stuff I've been reading. And then it hugs the ground all the way there, so it can't be spotted. Although it looks like the Russian electronic warfare people did shoot it down before it actually hit the building. It's possible, just out on the outside stream of possibility, that the Russians might do this off to themselves to create an incident that they can then use for whatever purpose. But there's no reason why they would, because they've got every excuse they need to escalate if they want to escalate. They don't need to stage a false flag attack to get public opinion in Russia behind escalating the war in Ukraine. They're already, you know, I mean, they've already been put under enormous pressure to do more than they're already doing. There's no point from their point of view in doing that.
The Pentagon inks, it says on antiwar.com, multi-billion-dollar contract for Javelin missiles. These are the anti-aircraft missiles, I believe.
They're anti-tank, aren't they, Javelin?
$1 billion contract with Lockheed Raytheon for these Javelin missiles, but it just will show us how much we know. I think you might be right. Yeah, that looks like an anti-tank missile to me. Manufactured by Raytheon and Lockheed Martin as Washington's stockpile dwindles. Taipei is due to receive hundreds of these weapon systems next year.
Well, interestingly enough, they did send quite a lot of Javelins to the Ukraine, and I've seen a picture of them, and they're actually a piece of junk. And the Ukrainians said, we can't use them. They're no good for anything.
Maybe the Russians have got some sort of countermeasure, which is fairly
simple. Well, no, so if you actually look at them, they're very, very bulky. Yeah? So you've got to cart them around.
Not like a Panzerfaust.
No, they're very bulky, and they've got a great big thing. So you've got to cart them around. They're very, very heavy, and, you know, they're very unmanoeuvrable, and they often don't work for various reasons, the batteries and stuff like this. But the thing is that Raytheon, who produces them, they want to sell them to the US government and to anybody else who's foolish enough to buy them. So this is all, you know, this is part of the reason for the war, is, you know, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin making profits, and that money then being pushed back into the political system and into the pockets of individuals like Lloyd Austin, the US Defense Secretary, who's on the board of Raytheon and a big shareholder. So there's an awful lot of profiteering going on in the Ukraine, which has nothing to do with anything military in a serious sense.
Yes, so also pro-ISIS fighter in Ukraine has received UK missiles and SAS training. Well, we're getting very involved, aren't we? Including shoveling all of our depleted uranium shells in Zelensky's direction.
Well, I mean, the leaks that came out the other week show that the British SAS have got 50 personnel in there. And since there's only 400 of them in total, that's a hell of a lot of people out there doing all sorts of stuff. And of course, the Russians, if they can get those people, will try and kill them if they're in the Ukraine. But at a certain point, they may, without warning, escalate and kill them in Britain, just as people in Russia have to be worried about stay-behind networks created by the British.
Well, if you want to hear what's going on in Ukraine, which we obviously do, the best place to listen to it is on RT. Oh dear, RT's been banned. But Afsan Rashani, who's a presenter of Going Underground, has been doing some great interviews recently. He's been carrying on just doing the same stuff as he always did, and this is, I think, the place to hear the truth. I mean, you know, not fake news, something really useful about what is actually going on over there. Anyway, about a week ago, just under a week ago this week anyway, he interviewed Cy Hirsch for the second time in the last few weeks, obviously after his Nord Stream pipeline. But this one, Cy Hirsch goes into much more detail about what he thinks is actually going on over in Ukraine, and particularly looks at the roots, what he thinks are the roots of the Russophobia in Washington.
There's the price of diesel, but there is still a gas line that was it was operational, I think, in the 60s, a long time ago, from Russia through Ukraine into some of the countries that in Western Europe, old Warsaw Bloc countries. You know, the old member of the Warsaw Bloc that existed as in opposition to our NATO, I guess, or whatever it was.
And they have to pay the transit fee.
Russia pays, even to every gift, Russia continues to pay a transit fee for that pipeline. And oil does flow, but it doesn't go to Ukraine. It goes through Ukraine. And there's always been incredible complaints over the years, I mean, for decades, about Ukraine plugging into it illegally and siphoning some of the oil out. But that was before the war. It's just, look, I don't know, I should be giggling about it because it's really quite a crazy situation. And as you know, the United States is, from the Kennedy days on, there's all sorts of speeches and talks and concern about the fact that we viewed the fact that Russia has so much oil, so much and so much underpriced oil for years, so much very clean methane gas, and they've been selling it, particularly one to Europe, at one low prices. A lot of keeps everybody warm and happy, and the business is flowing. And we always viewed that as a weapon, Russia weaponizing its oil.
Okay, well, I think we did talk about it on the Nord Stream episode. People can look at it on Rumble, but also in your article, you're talking about weapons, real weapons. And actually, there was an American WBAI host, Randy Credico, was in Dubai in transit from Donetsk. He wondered why a comedian was in Donetsk rather than U.S. journalists covering the war. And he saw with his own eyes the kind of killing that was been going on with U.S. HIMARS and so on. I understand that exports of arms from Ukraine are gaining traction here. They're not just killing people in Europe. Tell me about this booming weapons export market.
Well, I've not written about it, but I've obviously heard, you know, I don't know whether they call it the dark market or the black market. Very early, Poland, Romania, other countries on the border were being flooded with weapons we were shipping for the war to Ukraine. In other words, commanders of various, you know, I don't know what level. Often it wasn't generals, it was colonels and others who were given a shipment of some weapons would personally resell them or retail them back into the dark market. And including, they were the concern when there was a lot of concern. This was months after the war began last February. They included these handheld missile guns, missiles that could shoot down an airplane, you know, at a considerable height. And so there was a lot of concern about that. But that, and at one time about 6 months ago, maybe more, CBS wrote a story about it that they were forced to retract. They published CS television put on the air a show about the arms
forced
market.
To retract. These are mistakes.
No, they just they were just, you know, everybody's we're on the side of Ukraine. We all hate Russia, and you know, and Biden hates Russia, and he hates China, and Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and Victoria Nuland. Blinken, I call them Winken, Blinken, and Nod. They're all unified in their public distaste and contempt for Russia, all things Russian, and the same for China. I hear that Biden's in the process of, you know, going to try and discourage certain sales of goods from China to the United States. He's going to bar some. He's going to sanction those. I just don't understand where this immense outpouring of hate comes.
Cy Hirsch there talking to Going Underground, Afsan Ratchani, however you pronounce it this week, Martin. I mean, he's really talking a lot there about the black market that's developed in weapons since all this cash and all this weaponry is heading to Ukraine, and expressing some concern that actually it's quite dangerous if these anti-aircraft missiles are just for sale on the black market.
Well, it is. But don't forget, there's an awful lot of dark money being made here by the people who are concerned with it. You know, they are making a lot of money, and there's also an element of them using that black market to channel weaponry that's been sent to the Ukraine to other groups around the world that the US wants to support, for example, in Syria and elsewhere, and. The whole thing is a disgusting boondoggle, isn't it? I mean, and a river of blood. It's appalling.
The Israeli raid has killed three Palestinians in Nablus. This kind of stuff just almost sort of trots on and on. And this is the Middle East Eye, one of the latest articles from them. It's targeted suspects in the Jordan Valley, an attack that killed three British Israeli settlers. Three Palestinians were killed on Thursday morning by Israeli forces in the historic centre of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, the Palestinian Health Ministry said. So this is the alternative now to putting people on trial, is you just kill them. They believe that they were responsible for the deaths of some Israeli British citizens.
Well, I think that's, you know, as you say, there's no attempt to arrest people or put them on trial, so we don't know whether
British-Israeli settlers
were
killed.
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? British-Israeli. Yeah. I mean, that means they were born in Britain. So what right have they got to go to occupied Palestine and claim to be citizens there? And, of course, they were upon settlements. All the settlements in the West Bank are justified under Israeli law as military necessities. So we've got to have settlements in the occupied West Bank for military reasons. And that means anybody in those settlements is in a military installation and therefore a military target. Especially if they don't even come from Palestine in the first place.
Are Jewish migrants being set up here?
No,
they are to a certain extent, aren't they? They're being told, oh, this is great, God wants you to do this, it's going to be all wonderful here for you, but actually they're in the front line.
Well, they themselves, many of them volunteer to be in that front line, even though many of them are not from Palestine. They weren't born in Israel, like these British settlers, so-called. They were born in Britain. But they feel they've got the right to go and take somebody else's country. Now, I don't really approve of them being just killed out of hand like that. But on the other hand, I would make the legal point that all of those settlements are justified in Israeli law as military installations.
Well, anyway, there's been a lot of discussion earlier this week at the United Nations Security Council about all of this. But, of course, none of it virtually reported here. This is a meeting on Middle East peace at the UN Security Council called by the Russians.
We can see that there is a growing interest to the Russian initiative, which is aimed at ensuring collective security with the participation of all coastal states, both Arab states and Iran, also involving in this the outer circle of influential states. We welcome the positive changes, which even recently seemed difficult to accomplish, and I'm referring to first and foremost the restored relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran with the mediation by the People's Republic of China, and the advanced plans to return Syria into the Arab family. This is something that we've been working for a long time, and something that was started with Russian cooperation, namely the normalization between Damascus and Ankara, using the benefits provided by the Astana format. To a large extent, thanks to the initiatives from Al Riyadh, we are seeing steps to help speed up the settlement of the conflict in Yemen. At the same time, we know that what remained outside of this positive changes is the Palestinian issue. When we initiated this meeting today, our goal was to raise the attention paid to the unprecedented growth of tension and violence in the area of Arab-Israeli conflict. We think now, more than ever, it is important to reiterate the common denominators for the Middle East settlement that we have in the Council and in General Assembly decision: stop the threat of yet another spiral of armed hostilities and provide for a political horizon for a resumed peace process. The events in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in the East Jerusalem, and in the separation line between Israel, Lebanon, and Syria has increased the tension to a very dangerous level. Since the beginning of the year, as a result of military raids into Jenin, Jericho, Nablus, Huwar, clashes having to do with the violation of the status of the holy sites, as a result of that, more than 100 Palestinians perished, and there are thousands of wounded, and the number of Israeli victims is also growing, and this is something that the representative of that country has just talked about. This situation is also compounded by the Israeli strikes against Syria. This year, there already have been at least 10 such strikes, including the shelling of the Aleppo airport. This is the airport through which humanitarian assistance is being provided to those who are impacted by the destructive earthquake on the 6th of February. There is a growing number of incidents on the blue line with Lebanon, including the largest since 2006 in exchange of rocket strikes. The main reason for the regular outbursts of violence between the Palestinians and Israel remain the unilateral steps to create reversible facts on the ground and using force in order to protect such facts. We cannot go over in silence over the high pace of the building of settlements and outposts, land expropriation, demolition of houses, and random arrests. arrests. It is also not possible to close our eyes to growing radicalization of the Palestinian street and the growing rift between main Palestinian parties. This is fraught with a violent confrontation. Under these conditions, we, of course, think it's important to remove and prevent the symptoms of the worsening situation. But the absolute imperative for us here is to make sure that all leading players reaffirm that the two-state solution has no alternative, as it will meet the rights of Palestinians to have their own independent state with East Jerusalem as capital and the right of Israelis to have a peaceful and safe coexistence with their neighbors and in the region as a whole. It is only through returning to direct negotiations on all final status issues it will be possible to break the cycle, the vicious cycle of violence and radicalization and restore trust. But instead of trying to restore the political horizon, the United States and the European Union continue destructive attempts to replace real peace with some economic half measures.
That's quite a rapid translation there of the UN Security Council of Sergei Lavrov. The Russians convened the meeting, were chairing the meeting. The West were getting very upset that the Russians would dare chair a meeting about Middle East peace because they're in charge. Apparently NATO's in charge of peace in the Middle East, particularly the US.
As you say, Tony, the UN Security Council debates on this and the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and the biological warfare facilities in Ukraine, none of it reported in the Western media at all, because we don't need to know anything about Russia or its policies apart from the fact that Putin is Hitler.
What about the Middle East? What about the Middle East? I mean, Syria, the Israeli attacks on Syria he's talking about,
yes.
There? You know, there's so much going on, particularly... The sort of arbitrary assassination or execution of suspects by the Israelis. Palestinian suspects are executed, they're not put on trial.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a more wide range. Obviously, Lavrov was discussing the Palestine-Israeli issue, but it was covering much wider than that, wasn't it? It's talking about Syria, it's talking about the possibility of peace in Yemen, and of course the big game changer has been the agreements to send diplomatic representatives between Iran and Saudi Arabia, including visits by Rafsanjani to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi foreign minister turning up in Damascus to talk to Assad.
And meanwhile,
all
in
of
America,
which is very unwelcome to the British and the Americans, which is why we're not being told about
it. In America, United States bipartisan legislation is expanding on anti-BDS efforts. A bit of a mouthful there. I think you can come up with a bit of a better headline on Middle East Eye, folks, but this means that the boycott, divestment and sanctions is now going to become or even more of a criminal offence in the United States. It will block individuals and companies from participating in boycotts.
Well, isn't it extraordinary? They're going out of their way to prevent people carrying out non-violent boycotts. I mean, this is what happened in South Africa in the 80s. The big cities in the US refused to allow their pension funds to be invested in South Africa. It was very decisive. They're now saying that people can't carry out their own people-oriented sanctions and boycotts. But meanwhile, Sudan is under sanctions. Russia is under sanctions, which are supposed to crash its economy, none of which are actually legal. The only legal sanctions are sanctions agreed by the UN Security Council. If you try and impose any other sanctions other than that, they are not legal sanctions. And of course, you can try and force people by sanctioning secondary sanctions on people who do business with the Russians, for example. But quite obviously, the rest of the world, Mexico, Brazil, India, China, they are not, no country in Africa has put sanctions on Russia, none whatsoever. And the sanctions really are ultimately turning into sanctions on Europe by everybody else, including the Americans.
Well, actually, they've sanctioned themselves by sanctioning Russia, haven't they? So look, Luke, back to a final clip from the United Nations this week, from the Middle East peace discussions, which I imagine are kind of boycotted by the British. Where obviously we don't want Middle East peace because the Russians might be involved. And obviously, I mean, at the back of all of this, Martin, of course, is the Russian intervention in Syria, isn't it, really?
Yes, I mean, that was a decisive change of tack. In many respects.
It stopped them getting their 7 countries in 5 years,
yeah,
didn't it?
It did. And of course, there is criticism of the Russian intervention in Syria that it hasn't gone far enough. I mean, they're taking a position there that the attacks on Syria are unacceptable by the Israelis. I mean, they carried out an air attack on the Aleppo airport, which is a civilian airport, which is responsible for bringing in humanitarian supplies.
Bless you. Yeah.
Yeah. And but at the same time, what the Russians could do is they could shoot down those planes, but they don't do it. Because they don't want
well,
to.
Well, this
escalate.
Is interesting.
But on the other hand, they could do it.
You've reminded me of this whole situation with apparently trying to kill Putin. Well, actually, the Russians could have killed Boris Johnson when he went to Ukraine. The various other things have happened since the beginning of the war where the Russians know that these Western leaders are there, plus Zelensky, but they leave them alone.
Well, Naftali Bennett, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, says that he negotiated with Putin and said, and this stuff about him today, I think, in the media, and he said to Putin, Zelensky wants to know if you're going to kill him. And Putin said, no, I am not going to kill Zelensky. That, you know, that's not what, we don't fight like that.
Now, why is that?
Well, the reason for that is that ultimately he's trying, you know, don't forget, they try to force
it's
Zelensky.
It's not just because he's a nice guy, is it?
No, it's because they're trying to negotiate with the Ukrainian regime on an equal basis.
Or is it that they would rather deal with somebody they know than somebody unknown who might take over? I mean, think about, for example, the Western allies in the Second World War didn't want to kill Hitler because they thought he was a great person to have in charge because they knew how he ticked and he wasn't very good at the job.
That's true. I think that's certainly...
True of Zelensky?
That is true of Zelensky, and that would be one reason why the Russians wouldn't go after him. But apparently what happened is that Zelensky had been in a bunker up to this point, and once he'd been told by Naftali Bennett that Putin wasn't going to kill him, he then went to his normal office and then made a big press conference about how brave he was to be just sitting in his normal office, even though he knew, because he'd been told by the Israeli Prime Minister, that he wasn't in any danger. Now, of course, the Russians could easily say that they're not going to kill Zelensky and then just change their mind.
That's the sort of thing
morning.
That the Americans might do, isn't it?
Well, it's the sort of thing they well might do, yeah. Yes.
For example, Soleimani or whatever.
Yeah. I think the Russians are, you know, there's no real percentage in it for them killing Zelensky. Somebody else will take over, and, you know, it doesn't achieve anything. Although there's a lot of people in Russia,
that. Okay, I know, but the Russians are trying to persuade the leadership to negotiate, aren't they? It doesn't help to kill them.
Well, that's right. That certainly was true of the earlier stages of the war. I think as we're moving now into these...
Well, the Russians are still, as I understand it, trying to get negotiations going.
Well, they were quite happy for Xi Jinping to phone Zelensky. They said, OK, well, let's Xi have a go at trying to talk to him. But, of course, they know really that there is no deal to be done with Zelensky or with the West.
Anyway, back to the UN.
It's just not there.
Back to the UN. And one of the points that Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, made was that the West is trying to sort of cause all sorts of trouble for the Russians every time they use their veto and have these great investigations into, are they allowed to use their veto? Why should they use their veto? Whilst at the same time not complying with resolutions which have actually been passed and agreed.
Fairly recently, the United States and allies made their utmost to make sure that every time there is a veto used in Security Council, the topic is brought into the General Assembly for discussion. We didn't object to that, even though we saw that this was targeted openly against Russia, but we have nothing to hide. When we use a veto, we very clearly explain why, and we can certainly very easily repeat such arguments in the General Assembly. But the thing here is this. Veto is an inalienable right. Part and parcel of the mechanisms we have enshrined in the UN Charter. There is no violation of the Charter when a veto is being used. On the other hand, not complying with a past Security Council resolutions is a violation of the Charter. I think Article 25, which requires that everyone implement Security Council resolutions. Perhaps it's time for those who bury past resolutions to report to the General Assembly, to explain themselves to the General Assembly. Among such resolutions, decisions on Palestine, on the Golan Heights, on Western Sahara, on the Kosovo settlement, on the Iran nuclear program, and, of course, on the Minsk agreements regarding Ukraine. And this is something that we talked about in detail yesterday. Americans and Europeans are using the Ukrainian topic so as to use blackmail threats and bring over countries to their side and distract their attention from the Middle East and other regions of the Global South. So to say, we are going to be victorious over Russia any moment now, and then everything will resolve itself. This way, the crises who developing countries are trying to resolve are falling victim to double standards and the colonial instincts of the West, who are trying to dictate to the world in time what their requirements are, to ignore culture and the traditions of other of peoples, and thus offending international law. I would like to quote here, with your permission, an excerpt from Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State's interview to CNN's Wolf Blitzer on the 8th of April, 2022.
Answering a question about the Golan Heights, Secretary Blinken said, I quote, look, leaving aside the legalities of that question, as a practical matter, the Golan is very important to Israel's security, as long as Assad is in power in Syria, as long as Iran is present in Syria, militia groups backed by Iran, the Assad regime itself, all of these pose a significant security threat to Israel, and as a practical matter, the control of the Golan in that situation, I think, remains of real importance to Israel's security. Legal questions are something else.
I am not making value judgments here. I just simply quoted the statement made by Tony Blinken, who stated twice, leaving aside the legalities and legal questions are something else. So there you have an example of how resolutions are being implemented and how people position themselves within the UN.
Well, he's making it pretty clear there, Martin. These resolutions that are passed at the UN, the US is just ignoring many of them. If it doesn't suit them, they just ignore them. And yet they're trying to leverage as much discussion at the General Assembly, anti-Russian discussion, as they possibly can, saying, oh, the Russians have used their veto. Why have they done that? They shouldn't be doing that. But they're not. I mean, the US particularly are not, what Putin called deal ready. They just aren't trustworthy at the UN, are they?
Well, they're not trustworthy in general, not just the UN. But, of course, the UN Security Council, in fact, endorsed the Minsk agreements in 2014 and 2015. Those are UN Security Council resolutions. But you've still got Hollande and Merkel saying that when we entered into these agreements, we were trying to trick the Russians, and what we were really doing was preparing for a future war. They come out straight out and said it. And then they go on about the bad faith of the Russians vetoing this, that, and the other. It's just absurd. And, of course, there's been massive Security Council resolutions against Israel, loads and loads of them, and they're all vetoed by the US.
In the background to all of this, let's go back to listen to Going Underground again. It's a very entertaining and brilliant, informative programme. Even seems to have kind of gone up a gear. One of the other interviews earlier this week was a guy called John Perkins. You remember him, Martin, I take it?
Yeah, he wrote the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, didn't he?
He did. He's talking about the role he played and also looking at, I suppose, the United States' role in the world today.
So after the failure of the war in Vietnam, failure from the United States standpoint, at least strategically speaking, it wasn't a failure if you happen to be a major investor in military industrial industries. They saw the war as quite a success, actually. They made a lot of money, in other words, but it was a failure strategically. After that, it was decided that military might wasn't the way to go. That we needed to go with economic hitmen. We needed to essentially control countries through debt rather than the military. And this went on for many years. And it particularly revved up after 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved, when the United States was the only world superpower. But during this period of time, those involved in what we call the military-industrial complex, the ones who make the weapons, the big companies that make the airplanes, the Lockheed Martins and Boeings and so on and so forth, they were not happy with that situation. And they put a lot of pressure on the Carter administration. And so when 9/11 happened, we went back into that cycle. This was a tremendously great excuse to rev up the military side of our economy. And that's what happened after 9/11. And in some respects, the Ukraine war is giving us the opportunity to rev that up even more. And it's certainly happening. We're going in that direction in a big way. You know, I've tried, and I know you've had Greg Palast and Seymour Hersh and others on this program who are very good investigative reporters. It seems to be impossible to find out how much of this aid that we're giving to Ukraine is actually in the form of debt. There can't be any doubt that some of it, at least, probably a lot of it, is in the form of debt. But it's hard to tell, because what the American people, what the world is told, is that we're giving all this aid to Ukraine. The one thing we do know is that that is providing a lot of profits to the military industries in the United States. There's no question that they're making a lot of money off this. Who owes that money? It remains to be seen.
So, yes, that's John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I'll put both Cy Hersh and his interviews, the full version of those, up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. This is what they used to call, in fact, it was Desmond Morton's office in between the wars, Department for Economic Warfare, Martin, in Whitehall. But obviously that's the US version.
Well, economic warfare is has been going on for a long time. Warfare is
ramped up after 1989, though.
Yes, but 91. I mean, it's always been there. I mean, if you think about the First World War, that was economic warfare as well as warfare. You know, people were not trading with each other. There was a blockade on Germany by the British and their allies, and the Germans attempting to sink all the ships coming into Britain. That's economic warfare.
I'm talking about between the wars. So there wasn't actually a world war raging, but the economic warfare department was still chugging along.
Well, that's right, because countries, you know, we've got something called the Ministry of Defence, and we used to be much more honest by calling it the Ministry of War, because that's what it is. And it's always been the Ministry of War, but like Windscale, it's changed its name to Sellafield.
It certainly has. Anyway, so we finish with Tim Cohen's take on the coronation. And one of the things I think I ought to do, I mean, particularly with Prince Charles' interview with Jonathan Dimbleby earlier on, where he says that, you know, he was faithful to Diana, when it doesn't look likely that he was. There's an excellent independent piece just popped up yesterday evening on their website, called King Charles and Queen Camilla, a timeline of their 50-year relationship. Well, apparently they first had a relationship back in the 1970s, Camilla and Charles. And it's just such a shame that it was felt necessary to bring Diana in on anything, really. I mean, she was just cruelly abused and misused right the way through that whole process. And, you know, then discarded, and in fact dispatched, as we heard last week, over in Paris. So I'll pop that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But I did an interview this week with Tim Cohen, the author of The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea. Very controversially, Tim believes that, and I did give him a pretty hard time in the interview, you know, asking, for example, he said that when one of the previous times I interviewed him a year or so ago, that Prince Charles would never become king. Well, of course, he has become king. Just at least putting on him some of the obvious flaws in his arguments. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the final couple of clips from Tim Cohen, author of The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea. First of all, on Charles's role in the whole zero carbon agenda, which he calls a zero carbon scam, and whether or not it will affect his ability to be the head of state and a fair and honest king.
Carbon is very good for the environment, very good for plants, carbon dioxide. The more carbon dioxide there is in our environment, so long as there's life on Earth, plant life, the more oxygen that gets produced from plants as well for animal and human life. In fact, the whole world becomes more lush, becomes greener, becomes healthier, and longer lived with more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because more oxygen will attend that from the plants that consume the carbon dioxide. So the reality is, carbon dioxide is not a pollutant, never was. It's a pollutant on Mars because there's no plant life there per se. You know, there may be some algae growing. But on Earth, it's not a pollutant. It's very good for the environment, very good for life.
one of the most fascinating things about Charles is he's extremely close to both the hierarchy in Islam and in Judaism, isn't he? Can you just explain some of that? This is an aspect of his character. Very few people are aware that he's almost as close to the Jews as he is to Muslims.
Well, as they document in the Antichrist and Cup Tea, he claims descent, as does the British monarchy historically, from Jesus through the Merovingian lineage. That's an occult, fraudulent lineage. It's one of the bases for royalty in Europe claiming the right to rule, as it were, the divine right, so to speak. Secondly, and that's a fraudulent claim from Jesus. Secondly,
well, hang on, but yeah, because I mean, what they're saying is that Jesus had children.
Yeah, he didn't. But that's a fraudulent teaching from the occult realm, and it was popularized in The Last Temptation of Christ and in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and a variety of other works that have been put out there by non-Christians. But yeah, I want to answer your question also.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, but both Judaism, I mean, that's not an accepted view in Christianity, is it, that Jesus had kids? But what about the Jews and Muslims?
So the next point is the British monarchy officially claims to sit upon David's throne, and Elizabeth was his, Charles' mother, was coronated Queen of Thy People Israel, quote unquote, and her official lineage chart published in London, which is offered with the Antichrist in a cup of tea by the publisher Prophecy House, shows those claims explicitly on it. And so Charles, when he's crowned here on May 6th, 3 days from now, is going to be crowned King of Israel. And a lot of people don't realize that. He's not just being anointed with oil from Jerusalem, you know, from olives produced on the Mount of Olives, but he is being crowned King of Israel, not just England and so forth. So it's been taken seriously enough in Israel since the 1970s, in fact, Tony, for decades, to have multiple announcements in Israel and discussion in the Israeli populace about Charles specifically, him personally, being a descendant of King David, and what would happen one day when he's sitting on Britain's throne. So I suppose that is one reason to argue that maybe it's important that he be on the throne, though I didn't think it was necessary.
Well, I think it might be known in Israel. It certainly isn't very well known in the UK. But what about Islam?
So in Islam, Charles claims descent from Islam's prophet Muhammad. It's the Hashemite lineage. He's of the same lineage as Jordan's King Hussein, as Iraq's former Saddam Hussein, you know, et cetera. In other words, the same lineage that they would expect their Mahdi to come from, their successor prophet to Muhammad. Charles converted decades ago in the 1990s to Islam under one of the most prominent Sunni Muslims in the world, a guardian of Islam. And he also received an honorary doctorate in Islamic studies about, I don't know, several years later from the university there in Cairo, Egypt. He is viewed as a Muslim by the Muslims of the Middle East. And he is the most popular Westerner in the world, bar none, to the Muslims of the Middle East and the royal families over there. So he has the ability to step in and say to the Islamic world, potentially, I'm your Mahdi. To Israel, I'm your Messiah, unbelieving Israel. To Christianity, whether Christianity, you know, mainline Christianity won't accept it, but a cult, you know, fake Christians might. You know, I'm a descendant of Jesus. I have the right to rule over you, that kind of thing.
So that's Tim Cohen speaking to me earlier this week. I mean, amazing bit of spread betting, Martin, if Tim's right, that Charles is from the bloodline of David, so that makes him a royal Jewish person, potentially, from the Hashemite lineage in Islam, so that's descended directly from Muhammad, and also under this Merovingian bloodline, if you believe in any of that, which Christians really don't. But so this is like the most amazing mega divine right of kings that Charles could claim here if he wished.
Well, according to the person you've interviewed there, I don't think that would stand up to much.
Well, it does. I mean, if you look at this, I mean, you're just not listening, really, because all he's doing there, Tim, is talking about this line of David stuff, which has been going on in Israel, not in the British press, but in Israel. They believe that Charles is from the line of David.
Right, let's just pick up on one thing. He says that he's the most popular Westerner in the Middle East, and they all regard him as a Muslim. That's just plain
wrong.
Well, no,
some Muslims do. I don't think he said they all do. Certainly the Jews don't.
No, he said all. That's what he said. And therefore, he can be the Mahdi, and he can be the Messiah, and he can be the Antichrist. This is not historical analysis, Tony. It isn't. People are entitled to their opinions.
Well, okay, so
people who are historians...
You don't think that Charles Kennett could ever make those claims?
No, and I don't think he has made those claims either.
Right, OK, well, we'll put a link up to those claims on by Tim. And also, I mean, I've certainly seen the stuff in the Israeli press about Charles's links to the line of David. I mean, that's an normal thing.
They may believe that, but there is no evidence to suggest that King David even existed or that he had any long...
But what I'm saying is that the line of David is taken quite seriously in Israel. Well,
It may be taken seriously in Israel, but lots of things are taken seriously in Israel which are wrong. For example, most of the population probably wasn't descended from the Israelites in the Bible.
They certainly weren't.
We've not got DNA analysis to show that's not the case.
You don't need to do DNA analysis. All you need to do is look at the colour of their skin. They're Europeans.
Well,
most of them.
So the suggestion is that they are mostly descended from the Khazars who converted to Judaism in the 9th century.
They weren't from the Holy Land, in actual fact, they were from the Caspian Sea
that's
somewhere.
That's right, and in actual fact, the population on the planet, which is probably most directly related to the historical Israelis, are the Palestinian Fellahin. And, of course, all of this stuff is disputable, but, you know, somebody writing a book like that and making those claims, they can make them, but there's an awful lot of properly researched archaeology and history which just says, well, that's just rubbish. So there you go.
Right, so anyway, thanks, Martin. Any other stories you'd like to bring up this week before we say goodbye?
Not really. I think we've had a fairly good... It's been a rather kingly run out, hasn't it?
Well, of course, it's got to be. Listen, I've never seen a coronation before. Have you? Of course you haven't.
Not in this country.
No. Where?
Well, there's been other coronations.
You just watch them
not?
On the telly.
Well, there's been other coronations in other places.
Well, we shall see. I mean, I wish Charles all the very best of luck with this, but I think he's basically heading for a car crash, as Diana said there. We heard her from her 1995 interview saying that he's not really fitted to be king. I mean, the idea really is that someone who's the head of state, like the Queen, it's a pretty much a hands-off job. The idea is you get involved, if necessary, to bang heads together or to sort things out. But you're not a prime minister, you're the king. So good luck with that, Charlie, and thanks very much, Martin. And our final clip is Tim Cohen talking about what he believes may be Charles's role, alleged role anyway, in the future as a Jewish messiah.
All the nations will participate under Charles as the Antichrist, you know, under the Antichrist. And I'm not saying, you know, if he's the Antichrist at this point, there's no question biblically that he's the Antichrist. Anybody can see that by looking at the evidence even that I share on my YouTube channel, which is just author Tim Cohen. But that being said, we will get to a point where the nations, having served the devil and the Antichrist, you know, for the predominance of the Great Tribulation, that 3.5 years preceding Christ's return in Armageddon, we'll see, you know, Christ return to Israel. This is before Armageddon. He'll return to Israel. The survivors of Israel, which will be about a third of the nation, 2/3 will die, who are in Judea, which is where most of modern Israel's population center is, and I'm speaking of Israelite population,
well,
not
it's very
the so-called Palestinians.
I mean, literally, since the beginning of 2023, we've seen mass demonstrations by Israeli citizens, many of whom are, you know, even if it's Reform Judaism, they certainly identify as Jewish and identify with the Old Testament. They've been out on the streets protesting against their government.
Well, I mean, I neglected to mention this, but it is in my books, including my Coming Messiah, History in the Tribulation Period series, and I've talked about it for years, including in presentations. But biblically, there will be a civil war in Israel preceding the start of the Great Tribulation. So in the fourth year of the Tribulation Week, before the Great Tribulation starts, so before half of Jerusalem is taken captive in war, that will be preceded by a civil war in Israel, much as there was a civil war that created this schism between Judea and Israel, or, you know, two plus tribes and 10 plus tribes in the fourth millennium, the fourth day of the week of history from Adam and Eve, in the fourth year of the tribulation week, or in that year that the great tribulation starts, there'll be a civil war. So what we're seeing happening in Israel, and by the way, Tony, there's a huge amount of talk, and there has been for several months now, but it's accelerating in the Israeli press about a coming civil war in Israel. People are really fearful of that in Israel today because of the very things that you and the Western press are noticing. But like I said, that's being stirred up under Charles, the same people who have stolen the election in the U.S., who want to prevent the Israeli government from doing certain things. the people who are fomenting that civil war are largely outside of Israel. But ignorant Israelis are going along with it, liberals, non-Christians, you know, people who are part of the sexual satanic movement in Israel, in other words, homosexuals and so forth in Israel, they're fomenting a civil war. And that's the direction it's going in Israel right now.
So I think it's a little bit confusing for some, even for me. Can you just explain this whole idea of the weeks of the tribulation? Because I'd actually much rather hear about the number of years it's going to take. So if we imagine it kicking off with an enormous war at the beginning, is that how it starts or is that halfway through? As I understand it, it starts with a war, then there's 3.5 years, and then some kind of peace treaty, which then breaks down after another 3.5 years. Can you just spell it out for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. A lot of people think what you just said, that the 7 years begin with a war. That's not correct. In fact, it's not till you get to the second year under that second seal that peace is taken from the earth, that there's actual global warfare developing, if you will, and happening. So in the first year of the tribulation week, there's not global war. People look at what's happening with Ukraine and Russia right now.
Okay, so when you say the tribulation week, that's 7 years, is it?
Yes, let me clarify.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of people, the technical, correct biblical description is it's the 70th period of 7 years from Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. That's a lot of wordiness, and to me, I just summarize it by saying, okay, it's the tribulation week, a week of years. It's also called the tribulation period. Those are non-biblical terms, but they're summarizing phrases, if you will, for that period of 7 years.
So you're saying
from Daniel
the war
chapter 9, verse 27.
You're saying the war you think will break out in the second year, according to the Bible?
Yes, that's correct. And there'll be a progression of things that happen. So initially, not global war. Then in the second year, you have global war developing or happening. Then in the third year, you have all kinds of things that happen. But among those things are global famine, basically where it becomes very expensive to purchase the grain for the equivalent of a loaf of bread. You know, a day's wage to buy the equivalent of a loaf of bread's grain. So famine far beyond what the world has seen in modern history, developing in that third year, along with lawfare, all kinds of things described in my books. Too much to go into in this conversation, but that's the third seal. When you get to the fourth seal, the fourth year of the tribulation week, in that year, if you could take the fourth day of the week of history, which is 1,000 years long, you know, after Adam and Eve, and condense it into a single year, you get a pretty good picture of what happens in the fourth year of the tribulation week. But in that year, I expect to see civil war in Israel. I expect to see Israel successfully attacked and half of Jerusalem taken by force after that, after the city's encircled by the nations of the world, the whole world taking it by force from Israel. So we're talking about East Jerusalem, where the Temple Mount area sits. And of course, before that, they'll have restarted the sacrifice and offering. They'll have rebuilt a holy place before that on the Temple Mount. And I expect to see Charles mortally wounded, the formation of that global government, Charles to recover. He'll be possessed by the devil and his personality will change with that. And then that idol to Charles placed in the newly constructed holy place atop the Temple Mount, so that abomination of desolation described in the Olivet Discourses by Christ in the New Testament, that's what that will be. And then for the next 3.5 years, we have the Great Tribulation, where it's hell on earth. Basically, hell is following behind everything at that point that Charles, as the Antichrist being possessed by the devil, is doing for the following 3.5 years leading to Armageddon.
So it does sound as if he's going to have a job, Tim, in actually convincing people. I mean, if it's going to be so awful, how is he going to convince anyone to follow him?
I don't think he needs to. I think everyone already is, and they don't know it. You know, you can look at what the globalists are doing. They're doing it without people's permission, and they're doing it anyway, and they're getting away with it. We live in a world that's becoming more and more lawless.
So that's Tim Cohen, his book, The Antichrist in a Cup of Tea. I put the full version of that up, actually yesterday, up on BitChute, I think, and Rumble. So I'll put a link up to that full audio as well on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. 12 noon tomorrow is when Charles is going to get his new crown, and you know, obviously wish him the very best, but he certainly is going to have to take on a role. He's going to make a decision, hasn't he, between the World Economic Forum and Britain, because you can't really be a globalist and the head of state of a country unless what you're thinking is that you can just dissolve that country's sovereignty into something like the World Economic Forum. And it's particularly worrying hearing him talking about what happened with Diana in these kind of terms, where he's actually denying it to himself and to Jonathan Dimbleby that he was having a relationship with Camilla before the Diana marriage broke down. Anyway, so that was all those interviews from 1995. Very important, I think, from here to hear from Diana the day before the coronation. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips like the badger cull toll, 30,000 badgers last year. Thanks very much for that. Via not the BCFM politics show page, that's thisweek.org.uk, and you'll also find there the podcast, full length interviews, story links, and a comment page, as well as Martin and I's email addresses, so you can send him an email saying you think he's great, or me, that you think I'm dreadful, and it's absolutely fine. It's always useful and interesting to hear what you've got to say about how we managed to go. I mean, the interesting thing I think about Martin and I, just from understanding, we're both socialists, essentially believe in a mixed economy where you've got much of the infrastructure of the country run by government boards in a public, open fashion, and the rest of the money-making capitalist class get on and do their stuff too. But Martin does it from a Marxist perspective. I do it Marxist socialist perspective. I do it from a Christian socialist perspective. So that's how come we rub each other up the wrong way sometimes. My paperbacks, firstly about deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, that's Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, that's £15. Also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, that's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're both on eBay. And you can find the Siege of Heaven ebook, which has got all my articles from my RT column, including the ones they didn't print, and some from the last couple of years as well, all via www.bilderberg.org. Talking of which, we should be at the Bilderberg in 2 weeks' time. And next week, we've got a bit of a special outside broadcast. So we will be possibly setting up at 5 o'clock. So please, if there is a bit of a delay, just hang on, because we will be with you shortly at 5 next week. It might be a little bit of a delay setting up as we're doing an outside broadcast. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And over Sunday, breakfast at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. That PRSC stream, by the way, is talkradio.org.uk. That takes you straight there. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this programme, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable coronation weekend. Do please join us, but not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, talkradio.org.uk, and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday after your lovely bank holiday. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.